My favorite song, Across the Universe. La 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 la.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass, they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning. How's it going?
It's going all right. So, Trenchcoat Mafia is going to be joining us today.
Oh, okay.
He does Podcast X, and he's sometimes on Thume with Timmy.
Yeah, I think that's where I've heard him. I think on Thumecast before. So that's cool.
All right. So I'm going to dial him in and see if he's ready. So we got quite a few questions. I don't know if you want to do the album again, or I guess we'll just play it by ear.
Yeah, I guess we can see how much time questions fill up.
Yeah.
And then I did put together some albums.
Yes, for me, you said it was hard for you, but it was easy for me.
Well, it was hard to narrow it down.
It was easy for me because these are ones that, like, I heard so many times that I know the order of every song. You know what I mean? It's just...
I listened to so much music growing up, and I had tons like that. And kind of just... I went through so many phases.
All right, I'm going to dial them in.
Okay.
You went into the rap phase and then the new wave phase and...
Yeah.
All that.
Pretty much.
Trenchcoat, are you there?
Yup.
All right. I have Chris on and me. We haven't talked in quite a while.
Yeah, a coma will do that.
Yeah. It's been since Geek Brunch, maybe 2 years ago, I think. Maybe longer.
Yeah, it was... January of 2009, so it was, what, 4 years ago?
Yeah, it was a long... I've been podcasting for a long time. But I was wondering if you could let our listeners know a little bit about yourself before we start, you know, reviewing the Fourth World books.
Oh, you're recording?
Yeah.
First of all... I apologize for my voice. Since the stroke, it really messed that up. I host Podcast X. I've been doing that since 2006. There's a new episode up every week. And the most recent one, I review the Avengers with Santy's Fire, who's on the show sometimes.
Yeah, I was looking at your site, and I saw you you reviewed New Wave Hookers, one of my favorite porns.
Yeah, that had an underage Tracy Lords.
That was like one of the first porns I've ever seen. It was at least in the top five ones that I've ever seen. But, we're going to get started here talking about some Fourth World stuff. And this is from the Jack Kirby Fourth World Omnibus, Volume 2.
And we got on the plate Forever People and New Gods, and then a crazy adventure of Jimmy Olsen, which is probably the funniest of the three.
Even though Don Rickles wasn't in this issue.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he wasn't.
A trench coat, that's the first time that we've talked, so it's nice meeting you, as it were. I think I've heard you a couple times. I was just saying to Mike on Timmy Thum's podcast, I've heard you a couple times there.
Oh, yeah. I've heard you on Retrocast, of course, before.
The Retrocast.
Did you get a little outage there? I think I just lost him.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it's reconnecting. But yeah, these were, speaking of Don Rickles, these were actually pretty strong issues straight across the board, including the issue of Jimmy Olsen, I thought. I liked
that. Scrapper still cracks me up, man. He's the comic relief. It's so funny because Scrapper almost like is Scrapper and Gabby at the same time, because he's the one that talks the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he kind of lives up to both nicknames.
Trenchcoat, you back?
Yeah, I got cut off.
Ah.
I was just telling Chris I've heard him on your Retrocast before.
Mm-hmm.
What were you just talking about?
Oh, we were just talking a little bit about Scrapper and Jimmy Olsen, but we were waiting for you to come back so we can jump into Forever People.
Yeah, these three-way calls always seem to mess up, at least on my computer.
Ah.
So. Yeah, it will happen.
Yeah, Timmy was giving you crap for Ditko. You love Ditko, don't you?
Yeah, he's my favorite artist, of course, next to Jack Kirby.
Ah, there you go.
Because nobody's better than Kirby.
Oh, no.
So were you familiar with these issues already then?
Yeah, it turns out I actually read this and the next issue after this like years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, because I know that's one of the things that we sort of, because most of these I'm reading for the first time, and Mike's, you know, familiar with that. So that's kind of, I'm always curious if, you know, we have somebody on, what their, you know, history or background with the Fourth World is, if they're, you know, if they're coming from it's a reread for them or first time, you know.
Yeah, the issue after this, the Pact, I liked better. That was the origin story of Mr. Miracle, and that was awesome. But this story was good, too.
Yeah, I've enjoyed all of these for the most part. Some of them go in left field. Like, we just covered the Jimmy Olsens with the vampires and werewolves from a planet. And that was pretty goofy. But they all seem to have their charm in their own unique way.
Apparently, they didn't sell, though.
Yeah, they didn't last very long. But they let him cut loose, I think. I think mm-hmm. this is like, this is Kirby without an editor. He's listed as his own editor. So that's what I like about it.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you had a little bit of interference, but you definitely had, I think, part of DC's ability to get Kirby to come over to them, to Marvel. You know, he really wasn't gonna do that if, he didn't have some opportunity to work out the ideas. He wasn't really getting a chance to do at Marvel, or wasn't getting at least getting credit for, you know. I don't know if it worked out as well for him as he would have liked, you know, since he did end up going back to Marvel. But yeah, I mean, it's I'm glad that we got as many issues as we did, really, when it comes down to it.
Even though DC had Kurt Swan, I think, redraw the Superman faces on his covers for no good reason.
Yeah, I think that you, when these came out, you still had a DC Comics that hadn't really, you know, embraced diversity of style, you know, which really wouldn't happen till like the mid-80s. I think there was a lot of, you know, pretty of an establishment there that was looking to maintain a house style and really hadn't started to adapt some of the diversity that was going on over at Marvel in the 70s, you know?
I think it's still going on today. I mean, I'm not going to give my sources away, but there are people that ink and stuff like that are told, we want you to look like this. mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, so Superman was going to look like this, but and a lot of these covers were probably, you know, drawn over, but we noticed that Neil Adams was drawing a lot of these covers, at least on the Superman side. So,
yeah, and one overall kind of impression this time I thought was interesting is that we had two issues in a row that were inked by Mike Royer, and then the Jimmy Olsen issue was, you know, was inked by Vince Coletta again. And I think reading them back to back like that, I know at least for me personally, when I got to the Jimmy Olsen issue, I could really see the difference in the inks. You know, you hit the first couple pages of Jimmy Olsen, and the, you know, all the lines look way heavier, and you can tell the difference in the inking style of Vince Coletta. Things look a lot more, you know, heavily overdone.
Where you notice it a lot is in the faces.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially the faces of, you know, any of the characters. You see a more rounded structure rather than, you know, the Kirby type face. So I think Royer tended to keep Kirby, you know, the Kirby style, and then. I think that's why a lot of people do not like Coletta. mm-hmm. But he was a talented man. He did an awful lot of work.
Yeah, I think that's also why a lot of people like Mike Royer, too, because he seems to be pretty faithful to, or at least a lot more faithful to Kirby's lines than other inkers that, you know, worked on his stuff a lot.
That's pretty cool after watching Hippie Masala that we could get into the Forever People.
Hippie Masala?
Yeah, it was a do this podcast called DC Noise, and every now and then we do a movie. We each pick a movie, and one of the guys picked a documentary called Hippie Masala, which is about a bunch of European hippies that go to India to smoke a pot. It's fine spiritualization.
Well, if ever people are definitely the hippies of the Fourth World Saga, there's no doubt about that. What I think is kind of neat, and we can especially, I think, get into this when we talk about the New Gods issue that we're going to talk about today, but Kirby, I think, for someone of his generation, being from the World War II generation, I think he was pretty fascinated and interested in hippies and the youth culture at the time. I think that, you know, to sort of, maybe because of his line of work, you know, and creating, creating entertainment for, you know, at least what is even today commonly thought of as being for younger people, you know, maybe he made an effort to sort of stay connected, but
yeah, for being a veteran, he seems more open to it. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely, because I think you can almost, oh, and we could talk about it more in detail when we get to it, but, you know, I thought that was really more apparent than ever before in the New Gods issue, because there's a character in that book that's basically of his generation, and, you know, he sort of has the opposite attitude that I think Kirby had, where he's, you know, he's a World War II vet also, like Kirby was himself, but he's sort of, he's against the whole idea of like peace and love and pacifism and stuff that his son seems to espouse, and that doesn't really work out well for him in the story. So I think Kirby is kind of creating a critique of like his peers there in some ways.
Yeah, that was interesting, because that was exactly what I read. I read out of that is like Kirby could have been the older dude on the raft, and there's the younger generation. That was interesting.
Well, you guys want to get into Forever People number 6
more specifically? The Omega Effect. Isn't this the first appearance of him blasting stuff out of his eyes?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that would become a pretty, pretty usual power. But I don't think that we've really seen that directly so far. But yeah, last time we left the Forever People, we had, they were escaping from, the evil amusement park, and with, Sunny Sumo. They had connected with Sunny Sumo, who turned out to have the, anti-life equation in his mind. We see a bunch of troopers. I guess these are Glorious Godfrey's troops.
Yeah, I think we saw in the last issue, which I thought they were outside the tent, if I remember correctly, and that's where the super cycle is, and these Justifiers are out there. But
Justifiers, that's right.
Yeah, and the weird thing is they. They seem to be back in Happy Land now.
Well, they haven't gotten far, that's for sure.
But the art of the Justifiers, they look, that design is pretty damn cool.
Yeah, they have like the silver helmets with just the eye slot. And the super cycle is just kind of sitting there, and it turns out they have its own kind of built-in defense mechanism. So you know what this made me think of was, I think isn't it the very first Tim Burton Batman movie where the Batmobile is sitting by itself?
Oh, yeah.
Come up to it, and it's kind of like it activates the Batmobile's defense mechanisms. It kind of reminded me of that, but...
except I think in that movie, didn't he say, like, shields... and stuff like that. Wasn't he going audio?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah, he had a little mic.
Yeah, like, okay, so, yeah, voice activated. Yeah, I think this the super cycle just kind of does it on its own, doesn't it? Turns into a weapon, kind of.
Well, he makes you feel like this thing's alive. It's got some essence of being alive.
Yeah, like it's almost like an artificial intelligence or something.
Mm-hmm.
Which that would kind of... that would kind of fit with, you know, technology in these stories seems to be a little more complicated. Like the mother boxes definitely have like their own kind of willpower, seems like.
Yep, we get like a transformer.
Yeah, don't we have... I think we have almost another transformer somewhere later in these issues or something I read. It's reminding me of Transformers even more so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I'll come to it. But yeah, Sunny Sumo, he has his mother box, and he's basically using a broad speaker to kind of get his voice out there and use his anti-life equation power to sort of broadcast his ability and get it out to a lot of people at the same time. To kind of, they're looking to sort of liberate Happy Land. So even though that they've escaped, that they're, you know, not going to leave behind all the other people that we've seen that were already trapped there, but by and being tortured by Desaad. So this is kind of like they've gotten out, but they're taking out Happy Land altogether and destroying the place. And we see parts of it starting to like blow up and explode and everything like that.
Yeah. What do you think? Trench coat of Glorious Godfrey. Give us some of your experience with them.
uh, I remember him mostly from John Byrne's miniseries Legends in the 80s. I can't think of any other time I've ever seen him besides these comics. He's kind of an asshole. He just sends these justifiers out to get killed, and they're like, oh boy, we're going to get killed, yay. Go anti-life.
Yeah, he's like, he tells that one guy, you think these guys are prepared? We just transformed them, and then he sends them off. Sure, they're ready.
It'd be funny to have, someone should do a story from the perspective of one of these justifiers, or I mean, like all of, like, Darkseid has his own like troops, and like all of his lieutenants that work for him, like Godfrey and Desaad and Granny Goodness, like they all have their, there's so many, like, you know,
stormtroopers
basically, like day-to-day guys, like, you know, they're just trying to like make a living on Apocalypse. It'd be interesting. They should do like a story from the perspective of one of these guys that's just like gets sick of all their shit.
The only time I've ever seen anything like that was in the Star Wars Legacy. There was an issue from the point of view of one of the stormtroopers. He was basically, in effect, the hero of the story. And It has a happy ending. He lives, as opposed to most stormtroopers.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have a pretty high fatality rate. Yeah, that actually sounds interesting. That kind of is what I'm talking about here, because that's pretty direct equivalent. You know? You could definitely draw some parallels between Darth Vader and different people in the Sith and the Empire.
So is like Peter that. Cushing the, is he Desaad? He's just sitting and blowing shit up.
Yeah. I could see some visual comparisons there.
You just need a hood.
Yeah. A
hood over him.
Yep.
And in this issue, I think Desaad just slaps around. Oh, Darkseid slaps around Desaad like he's his bitch.
He always is doing that.
Yeah, pretty much.
Desaad's like always on his knees, and he's always doing things behind Darkseid's back. So I don't think Darkseid even trusts him. Like, I think they have the similar agenda, but I don't think he trusts him. I don't know how many times I've seen, even in the cartoon, I think in the Superpowers cartoon, him blasting Desaad with his Omega beams. It's like, you asshole.
And I know we've mentioned it before, but whenever I see the two of them together, I'm always thinking of, it always reminds me of Cobra Commander and, you know, like Destro, or Major Blood, or pick any of his people that work for him. Definitely reminds me of Darkseid and his crew.
It's very good analogy, because the only thing that keeps Cobra from winning is themselves.
Yep.
Because all of those guys secretly hate each other and have different agendas. And yeah, the only one that I've seen that is kind of mindless is his son Kalibak. He doesn't give a shit. I mean, he just wants to go destroy shit.
Yeah.
But we've even seen Mantis earlier in issues wanting to do his own thing. He's like, you gave me this world, and now you're trying to take it away from me. You know?
It's probably a generational thing, but Darkseid and Desaad remind me of Mr. Burns and Smithers from The Simpsons.
Nice. I could see that too. That's pretty awesome. I would love to see like a Simpsons episode where Burns and Smithers are an Apocalypse. And you could have like Bart Simpson flying in on Orion's Astroglider. That'd be awesome. But yeah, I mean, that's what I liked is, well, you get to this scene between Darkseid, who's, you know, obviously pissed that Desaad has failed him again as they watch the destruction of Desaad's happy land. And I really liked that you think that the focus of the splash page where we see Darkseid's Omega Beam, the Omega effect, shoot out of his eyes, be the main focus of the panel, and that be all that's really going on. But we have Viken creeping in from the back, and I actually kind of felt like, you know, by this point, Darkseid's power is pretty well established. I actually did feel a bit of a concern for Viken coming in on his own like that.
So did I, because Viking's strength is that he could talk to mother, that big old ass mother box that Sonny Sumo has now, and he doesn't have the mother box.
So I liked how that kind of set up his bravery.
Yeah.
That he just kind of, I mean, Darkseid's basically a god, and he just rushes him. You know, pays the price, but I thought that was pretty cool. I liked that scene.
Yeah, he jumps right into the Omega Beam.
Yeah, basically.
Well, the other thing that I liked is that you get to see Desaad's fear, because he's kind of freaking out from their perspective that a Sonny Sumo has the anti-life equation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of in a panic mode. And Darkseid's like, fuck this. I'm going to just go blast the shit out of him. And that's what he does. Definitely.
Recognizes a threat there. The Omega Beams he uses are basically they're finder beams. The Omega Effect creates finder beams. So these that come from his eyes, they're basically search out, like almost like heat-seeking missiles, the Forever People. And start, basically when they hit them, you know, they disappear in a bunch of like Kirby bubbles, Kirby crackle. until Seraphim is sort of by himself. He's the last one to remain after the rest of them are all hit by the beams. And we get another scene with the two of Darkseid and Desaad. And this is where kind of they're in the wreckage of, they're walking in the flames in the wreckage of Happy Land. And this is kind of Darkseid's chance to do his, like, soliloquy, kind of. He's basically talking to Desaad, but he's talking about his plans and talking up their devastation. And we see kind of like, like, Darkseid basically bitch slaps Desaad, puts him in his place again.
Because Desaad's pissed they let the one guy live.
And that's where his mistake is. See, I just read something recently in Grim Fairy Tales, and he didn't make the mistake that Darkseid made. They killed the last person. It's like a lesson learned. In this case, Desaad is right.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you leaving him alone? And it almost like, I got the impression that Seraphim felt left out, like he wanted to be blasted there for a second. He's like, don't leave me.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, he feels like he's the last one of his friends, so it's just like, he'd rather not be left alone, you know, if that's the case. But finally, he gets motivated. I think the police, because of all like the destruction, Happy Land start to show up, and he finally kind of gets it together and uses one of the cosmic cartridges on his hat to power the arrow van and get out of there, and that actually takes him to the super cycle that we saw in the beginning of the issue. But all in all, it's a pretty, I'd say it's one of the darker of the issues that we've had as far as, you know, the consequences for the group and, the situation that they're in towards the end.
Yeah, I thought this was dark, and I thought the New Gods one was dark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, darker than usual, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, this, so New Gods number 6, I mean, well, so that basically kind of wraps up sort of where, leaves things where we're at for next time with the Forever People, is that Seraphin is, actually, the last panel, you know, he's sitting in the super cycle, grieving the loss of his friends, and he doesn't notice, but there are justifiers creeping up the hill, ready to attack him. So, we'll find out what happens next eventually there, but in New Gods number 6, we pick up...
we got a backup real quick.
Oh, yeah.
It just gave some backstory about Big Bear and Seraphin. There's some more justifiers or soldiers coming down to New Genesis and blasting, or trying to destroy with their Death Star gun the city that they're in. And Big Bear and Seraphin break it up. His bullets seem to be able to do anything. Like,
make the cartridge.
Anything to... I mean, they seem very powerful.
Yeah, they are kind of, like, pretty convenient as far as, like, a plot device. Kirby can kind of use them to do what he wants them to do.
And in that issue, I just want to say they finally talk more about Big Bear's strength. Like, you always assumed... he was strong, mm-hmm. but they really mm-hmm. talk about it in that issue.
Yeah, that's true. It does kind of solidify. I noticed that he doesn't really, like, you'll read some comics where they'll just lay out their powers in exposition. You know, and the Fourth World certainly has a share of exposition, but as far as, like, powers and stuff like that, they kind of get revealed over time, especially when it comes to the Forever People.
Yeah. Like, I still don't know what Moon Rider can do.
And Kirby basically ruins his own story because after you think the Forever People have died, in the last panel, it's like, be here next issue when we reveal what happens to the Forever People, really. So apparently Darkseid didn't kill them. He's supposed to be so big and bad, but he apparently had mercy for some reason. Because
that's true.
Yeah.
Forever People are alive and well.
I was going to say, it's like when he killed Batman, supposedly he just sent Batman back in time. For no good reason.
Yeah, it seems like his Omega Beams displace whoever they hit in some form. And I don't know how they get displaced, but that's what they seem to do.
Yeah, it's almost like they switch the cliffhanger from whether or not they're alive to yes, they are alive, just and the cliffhanger is where they got sent to. But yeah, I wonder if that was Kirby or if editorial did that, wanted to. I always assume that Kirby writes these cliffhanger statements at the end of the issues, but I wonder if, you know, the ending was too dark, they thought, or whether it was him or the editorial thought the ending was too dark, so they wanted to reassure people.
It wasn't that dark. He left one guy alive.
Yeah. Nowadays, it doesn't seem too bad.
Yeah, if you look at the credits, it says edited, written, and drawn by Kirby. So
that's true.
It's weird because they don't have any of the editors. Like, it just lets. I think this is his free for all. I think the one that is edited not by him is the Superman one.
Probably, yeah.
And it's probably because it's their property. They don't want them to muck with it. They don't want Superman to be smoking pot or anything.
I would like to see that, actually.
Well, that does happen in the form of a different color of kryptonite sometimes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or magic. Mixel-piddle-lick.
Yeah. Magic will mess them up pretty good sometimes.
Yeah, I never understood why magic would affect a Kryptonian. I just don't get that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they
I think
up.
It's just to give it him a weakness other than kryptonite.
Right. Yeah. Just so that you have writers have a plot line that they can use, you know?
Yeah. So that takes us to this New Gods number 6 and this glory boat. And one of the things I really liked about this besides the art, I mean that fish design with a battering ram. it's like a whale with tusks and a battering ram for a chin. It's pretty unique. But one thing I liked about that is I'm very big into like post-apocalyptic type stuff, and this felt like it. This felt like kind of like the end of the world, and there was a couple of people on a raft.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, because we saw this big pink crazy looking whale thing at the end of last issue, and Kirby doesn't waste any time giving us or satisfying the potential of the creature to use that battering ram aspect of itself, because it pretty much we get, you know, the typical Kirby opening. We get a splash page and then turn to a double page splash, and the double page splash is the creature smashing the shit out of a ship. I mean, it's just, he basically just destroys it. There's people flying everywhere. There's canisters and equipment, pieces of the ship flying all directions, and like you said, you have a few people on a raft, and it's just basically survivors of this shipwreck from the SSS Aurora. And it's a father and his son and daughter.
It's like the Gilligan's Island SSS Minnow.
Yeah. Just a little bigger.
Only guy allowed to do double page spreads, because in comics today they're everywhere, and unlike Kirby, they're used for no good reason. Just to take up space.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing I appreciate about Kirby. If there's a double page splash, it's because it's, you know, an impactful moment, and he really liked to open up the issues that way. And you, a lot of times, wouldn't get them anywhere else unless there was a really, you know, really big dramatic moment that justified it. Because I don't think, you know, like later on in this issue, at the very end, we get a couple more splash pages, but they're, again, they're pretty impressive artistically, and you know, pretty awesome moments from a storytelling standpoint. Go ahead.
Well, this raft has three people from the SSS Aurora, a father and his daughter and son. And like we've already kind of told you, the son is like anti-war. He doesn't think you should fight at all. The father is a veteran. And the daughter is kind of neutral, I guess. They don't really go into her character much.
Not too much. It's like the father and the brother, they kind of both think they know what's best for her, you know.
But they're trapped in the middle of the ocean, or Kirby Crackle. it's supposed to be ocean, but it looks like Kirby Crackle.
Yeah.
And Orion pops out, and the father thinks he's like part of the Navy. And he's like, hey, you need to help us. You need to get out of here. So he somehow attaches his his glider to the raft and takes him out, but he's like, hey, I'm going to war. Are you sure you guys want to come? And they're like, oh, yeah, we need to get out of here.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is they end up going to this it doesn't even look like a boat to me. It looks like a pyramid in the middle of the ocean. And it's got a mummy on top of it. And it's all wrapped up. And it was Light Ray in the coils. He was wrapped up. And he used the Astro Force to get him out.
Yeah, what I liked was the mummy wrappings are actually kelp. It's like the Deep Six used living steel-fibered kelp to wrap him up.
Where'd they find that?
Well, that one guy from the Deep Sips can transfer, like, he could touch things and turn it into whatever he wanted, it seemed like. Yeah. In a previous issue, he had one arm that could, was it one arm that could transform it and the other that could destroy it or something? I can't
remember. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, one hand. Yep. Kind of. Or like, yeah, he could transform stuff with his one hand, turn it into something else, and then, yeah, destroy stuff with his other hand, I think, but... Yeah, the Deep Six, they have a pretty bizarre repertoire, it seems.
This thing that they're floating on doesn't even look like a ship. It looks like a piece of wood right coming out of the water, like that's a little island or something. It's bizarre.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I feel like I never really... never really decided exactly what it was in my mind as I'm reading the story. I mean, I understood it to be kind of like, you know, like sort of like the, from this point on, it's kind of where the story revolves around is that ship or like floating thing or whatever it happens to be. But it does look like it's made out of wood, whether it's meant to be or not. It's kind of weird.
It's a portable. I was going to say it's a portable plot device.
Yeah, it is with a huge glob of vomit that's in the middle of the ship with an eyeball on it.
Yeah. Well, I guess actually it does say in the one in the initial panel that we see, it does say that it's made out of aged wood and it's an ugly, misshapen craft.
It is very ugly.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look like it would float. I don't understand. It has like no... It's so misshapen, it doesn't look like it's something that you'd want to be on.
Yeah, it's not like a yacht that they're going to, you know, film a music video on with a bunch of women in bikinis laying around or anything. Light Ray... When we last saw him, he was told by the High Father to stay on New Genesis and to stay out of it. But he disobeyed and came to help out Orion. And he looks pretty satisfied with himself when, Orion undoes his mummification there. He's got a big smirk on his face. He's pretty pleased with himself.
Yeah. And but I don't. I guess I don't understand Light Ray's powers either, because he seems to have be able to fly at the speed of light, but he also seemed to turn this weird creature into a cube.
Yeah, he
can rearrange atoms.
Well, one thing I will say for Kirby is that he sometimes didn't. Fixate details like that real specifically. You kind of go with the ride and enjoy the craziness of it, but I mean, for the most part, Light Ray's powers seem to be what you would expect from his name. I mean, he seems to be able to use light in a lot of different ways and manipulate light and stuff like that, but when he takes the this green glob of a creature with a floating eyeball that you mentioned, they call it an organic director. And apparently Light Ray knows that the Deep Six have made it out of life from the sea. So, yeah, it looks like somehow in some kind of Kirby science, Light Ray is able to use light to play with its organs. And that part's censored, but then after that, plays with its atoms and takes out all of the apocalyptic aspects of it, and to make it something of his world of New Genesis. So, I did think it was interesting though that like you do see a contrast between Orion and Light Ray. You know, Light Ray's approach to things is to try to solve the problem without direct conflict, where we see how Orion is kind of both worlds, because his instincts are to kind of just are to fight and to smash things.
Yeah, and at this point in time, we don't know that Orion is Darkseid's son.
Right. But
they've implied it, though.
Implied it, and they've implied it. He's implied it pretty heavily.
Oh, yeah, with the eyebrows.
Yeah. And even if not Darkseid's son, like, maybe you wouldn't know that much, but you'd probably guess at this point that he has some kind of connection to Apocalypse. Yeah, one important like subplot of the story is that the father and the son on the raft, you know, the father basically, he's a World War II vet. He really is not good with his son. And
yeah, he calls him Marshmallow.
Yeah, he really calls him Marshmallow, calls him, you know, Lily Liver. Like, he basically has no respect for his son. His son's more of a pacifist and doesn't believe in conflict. So his father talks a pretty big game.
It's kind of like Trenchcoat. He doesn't believe in conflict.
Yeah, I was going to say... But the father's the one who turns into a marshmallow as soon as the Deep Six show up, because he's terrified, and he turns into a total pussy.
Yeah, he does. It's a reversal of roles, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Because when it comes down to it, the one that able, even though you know he doesn't really want to or believe in it, the one that's able to stand up and... you know, basically defend his family as the son. And all these Deep Six guys have names, but Great Jafar is the one that shows up on the ship. He's like this green seaweed looking monster. But he has power to turn people into the Silver Surfer. Basically. he grabs the son's face, Richard, I think his name is, and when he lets go, basically his head, not his whole body, but his head is silver and featureless, and it looks like it kind of extends down into his chest area.
And it killed him, for the most part.
Pretty much, yeah. Fortunately, Orion and Light Ray show back up and take out Jafar so that nothing further happens to the daughter and the father, who the father's kind of at this point like gone into flashbacks of being in Normandy on the beach. So he's kind of lost it at this point.
Yeah, now the Deep Six are the Deep Four.
Yeah.
Because Orion's took out two of them so far.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses his astrogliders to send the daughter away.
Yeah. And that happens pretty fast. I actually got to the end of the issue, and I had to flip back and remind myself of what happened to her, because she gets out of there so quickly. Because she wasn't around anymore. But we kind of get this as, I guess, I'm assuming, like, sort of a finality to this battle with the Deep Six that's been going on. They kind of launch the last attack on the weird old wood boat.
I wonder why why Light Ray strapped the father to a post and just left him floating.
Yeah, I wonder if he was just afraid because he was kind of out of it that he might fall off the boat. And I mean, Orion doesn't think much of like the fact that he's done it and thinks Light Ray's a fool for doing it. But he probably thought that he, like, in the commotion, he might just like fall into the water. Doesn't really know where he's at. But there's this.
Maybe he did it. Oh, I was going to say, maybe he did it to punish him. You're going to act like this? Okay, I'll strap you to this piece of wood.
Any final thoughts on that issue?
Well, I was going to say we got basically the creature, what was once the creature inside the boat that Light Ray transformed turns into this huge, like, missile weapon, kind of crazy. Like I mentioned earlier that there was a couple splash pages towards the end of the issue, and we basically have that pink, that huge pink fish battering ram creature.
That sounds ridiculous, but it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. It is pretty, it's awesome. It's also, it is pretty ridiculous. I'll give it that.
A pink fish battering ram.
And,
I don't understand how the kid got his face back in the end.
Yeah.
It didn't bring him back to life. What was the point of that?
Well, they strapped him to that machine, I think. And then I don't know what happened.
Yeah. I did think that he was going to live when he got his face back. When I saw his face back.
Instead, they attached him to the rocket and shot him into that huge explosion. They didn't even leave him for his father to bury. They're like, oh, we're just going to blast the shit out of him.
It's almost like they needed, like, Orion's criticizing Light Ray that he fights battles like a planner instead of a warrior, he said, and that they're all his pawns, basically. Like, he's more of a strategist. It's this weird combination of things. It's almost like, I almost got the impression that, it says Light Ray is imprinted on the life cube, is now fully grown, and it carries on its glistening warhead the living, the dead, and the fiery trumpets of the source. So it's almost like those are the ingredients that were needed to create this explosion or something.
To create a soup.
Yeah.
A soup of Kirby Crackle.
Yeah, and it's pink, so I guess maybe that's like the...
I think they destroyed the pink fish battering ram as well.
Yeah, the pink fish battering ram.
And I think that the Deep Six are now the Deep Zero.
Yeah. The Deep Six and their pet are gone. So it's actually Deep Six plus one. plus one pink battering ram.
Battering ram.
So... the end of the Deep Six New Genesis war of phallic weapons and creatures is concluded. And it looks like next time we're going to get some connections between Orion and Scott Free.
That's what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're getting there.
That's one thing that you can't say for Kirby. He kind of tells you what the next issue is going to be.
Yeah. I guess they're looking for any way to get people to buy these.
I would love to see what they did sell, though. Like, if they sold more than comics today. Or if then, you know, comics back then sold a lot. So what was a poor sale then?
Yeah.
Did this sell 100,000 copies and fail, or was it more like 50?
Yeah, I'm not sure what comic sales in the 70s were like, but I think they were decent.
I noticed in the 70s, no, maybe it was the maybe it's the early 80s. They used to have the, what they still have is the publication, a little blurb that comes out every year.
Yeah.
Where it tells you how much, what the sales were like on that book. Because I read a Wonder Woman that was like in the, I think it was in the 70s, and it was 300,000 copies. I was like, that's still a damn lot. That's the bestseller now in today's market. And you have to have like a cover with all the flags of the United States on it to get that number.
Yeah, a different flag photoshopped in.
Yeah, sure. Either that or Obama, you put him on the cover.
Yeah. Well, I'll say that, you know, the Jimmy was pretty good, like probably the best one we've had in a while. It reminded me more of the stuff that we got in the earlier, his first few storylines of Jimmy Olsen with the, you know, with the Harrys and all that.
Yeah. Trenchcoat, are you still there?
Yeah, I dropped out for about a minute.
Yeah, I saw the little reconnection lines, and I didn't know if you came back.
Yeah. Skype does this every time. Like I said, it can't really handle three-way calls, at least not on my computer.
Ah.
But what was Orion talking about? When they die, they go to the source? When did they establish that?
I don't think they established it other than Mentron kind of implied it in the earlier issues. But I don't know if that's a well-known fact of all New Gods, or they haven't really gotten to the source wall yet.
And he even said that kid who died was going to go to the source. And he wasn't even the New God. So, yeah. The only time I've ever seen the source wall was X-Men Teen Titans, when Darkseid became part of it at the end.
Yeah. In earlier issues of this, their Mentron, I think, is trying to get to the source wall. Mentron isn't really helping nobody. He's he saved Light Ray's life in an earlier issue, but he seems to just be floating on his chair looking for the secret of life. In other words, how did the Big Bang come about?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a long time ago, but it was actually the last, flipping back, it was actually the last issue in New Gods that started that way with Metron looking at the creatures, the like titanic gods that had tried to enter the source and were destroyed by it. So he's kind of like, yeah, so I wouldn't say it's been explicitly said, but it's been implied that the source is kind of like, as it, you know, sounds, this is the source of all things, kind of.
And I know Kronos is big in that in the Green Lantern books, but I don't like remember the first appearance of Kronos, because Kronos was a guardian that was trying to figure out, you know, the meaning of life, or the, you know, the history, you know, how everything was created. I don't know which one came first.
I was going to say, wasn't Kronos a Green Lantern villain?
Yeah, he is a Green Lantern villain. But before he was a Green Lantern villain, he was a guardian that was a super scientist that wanted to become, and he let emotion get in the way, and the guardians kind of booted him.
You're talking about Kronos with a K, blue guy.
Yeah, the blue guy. You were talking about the time guy with the white face and the green pants, striped pants, the Atom villain.
So,
yeah, Kronos, the time villain. I really like the 90s Kronos. I don't know if you read that, Trenchcoat, but it was
Was he a hero?
Yeah, he was. Well, I guess you could call him that. He's kind of like an anti-hero, or a hero that was coincidentally a hero, but he had his own agenda.
I never did read that. I don't seem to read books about anti-heroes. That sounds like the Irredeemable Ant-Man.
And you didn't like the Irredeemable Ant-Man?
I never read it.
Oh. Now, that guy was bad. I'd never seen anything like that.
They canceled the book before I had a chance to read it.
It's worth reading because I think it would go good with on your if you reviewed it. Especially a couple of them.
I don't believe Cap let him into the Secret Avengers.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of people knew exactly what he did, except for himself and the reader. Because I don't know if a lot of people witnessed everything, like having sex on a gravesite of somebody he was looking at in the shower, and I don't know, it was just bad.
That is cool.
So, yeah, you were telling us before we lost connection there that this was one of your favorite Superman's pals, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the one of the better ones in a while, I think. There was stuff that I enjoyed about the, the Transylvain storyline that we just had and Don Rickles beforehand. There are parts of the stories that I liked, but this reminded me a bit more of the first couple storylines that we had from Jimmy Olsen. We have kind of a crazy adventure. It starts off in Scotland with a guy named Ian McGregor. And
Star Wars connection.
Yeah.
Except it's you and McGregor.
Right. But yeah, he gets attacked by what he thinks is a Loch monster, a Loch Trevor rather than Loch Ness here.
I wonder why they didn't do Loch Ness, because that's not copyright.
I don't know, maybe just to make it a different monster. I mean, there's
Trevor Loch, sounds like a person.
Yeah. I mean, Loch just means lake, and there's lakes. There's a bunch of different locks all over Scotland, so I don't know if Trevor is a real one or if he just made one up. Because there are plenty to choose from, but it's enough that it becomes a news story, across the sea over in Metropolis. And the Newsboy Legion and Jimmy Olsen are trying to convince Morgan Edge to let them take the whiz wagon again and go look into the story and check out the... Does Morgan want them to go and look at it, or are they wanting to go there?
No, I think Morgan wants them to go to... I think Morgan's agenda is to kill them.
Right.
I mean, Morgan's been trying to kill them for several issues now. He tried to kill Clark and Jimmy... Mm-hmm. Several issues ago, and he's working with Inner Gang. He's always on the phone with Inner Gang, and he's such a pansy because when he's going to even destroy like Metropolis, he gets in his hovercraft and gets the hell out of there, and things don't ever get destroyed. But Flippadippa is excited.
Yeah, he's all about it, and I like how
Flippadippa. You got to give him credit. I mean, he's the bravest of the Newsboy Legion, because he always takes the risk of going underwater while the other guys are above water. And he goes and does stuff. Do you know what I mean? He opened up he got them out of where they were trapped in that Inner Gang sewer before. Mm-hmm. He got them out of there, and now he's going to go try to find the Loch Trevor.
True.
Are the Newsboy Legions supposed to be a bunch of clones? Because we see in the backup story, there was a Legion back in the 40s.
Yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, in the you raised a good point. And the issues that we're reviewing are in the like a collected edition, and we're not seeing the extra backups that you're seeing, because these were like giant sized books, so we're only seeing like the first part. But yeah, they created the Newsboy Legion back and then, and these are clones, and that's why you have that little Scrappa, the Scrappa Trooper. they introduced that guy a long time ago, and he really has panned out for them. But there's a lot of them. If you go back to earlier issues, there's like a whole there's like so many clones of the paratroopers that, and he just keeps one of them in his pocket. But they're all clones.
I thought the main Newsboy Legion here, though, I thought that they were the sons of the.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And then then some of them have been cloned, right? Like particularly Scrapper with the Scrapper Troopers.
So they showed the old Newsboy Legion, and they're like the parents, and these are the sons. They look almost exactly alike, except they even gave the occupation of the parents. Like one's a doctor and one,
yeah,
drives trucks or something. I don't remember.
I like that Scrapper wants to go along with the plan to go to Scotland just so he can get the hell away from Morgan Edge.
Well, Morgan Edge is an asshole, and as soon as he sends him off, he's on the, you know, the video conference with the Inner Gang.
Yep. Yeah, he definitely is not a hero.
Don't like the way Scrapper talks with the Scottish accent that Kirby depicts phonetically, though.
Well, he makes fun of that, too. They make fun of his accent.
Well, he got accents all over the place in this one. Because we got, we got Scrappers. Well, Scrapper kind of has a...
New York?
Like a Brooklyn
New Jersey?
Accent. Yeah, and then we get like a bunch of characters with Scottish accents, and yeah, Kirby writes them all phonetically. It gets kind of like crazy when later on when Scrapper's talking to a Scottish guy and they're both talking in accents.
I don't know if I recently read a Crossed annual, and it crosses over into the Crossed webcomic that's available for free. It's like Crossed Wish You Were Here. And it was written with accent, and it was written so heavy, I couldn't read it. I literally, all the caption boxes, every bubble, everything was written like that. And I actually had to stop 20 pages in because it was giving me a headache. And I was trying to read it out loud because sometimes you have to.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's kind of accurate because I actually have been to Scotland and there were some people over there speaking English that I couldn't understand because their accents were so thick. So it's sort of accurate. Especially like older people.
Yeah, I don't know if Simon Spurrier is from that area and it just came naturally to write it like that, but it made it near impossible to, because, man, it just... Even Bill had a hard time, and he's more patient than I am.
In this case, the Scottish characters, their accents probably... It's written phonetically, but it's a little more stereotypical. It's not too crazy.
Stereotypical, and you could kind of understand it.
Yeah.
I read it out loud.
Too bad. Yeah.
But I don't know why Scrapper wanted to blend in, so he got himself dressed up in a kilt.
Yeah. he basically wears the tartan, and he's got like the Scottish hat on and matching socks and everything.
Yeah, he wanted to blend in is what he wanted to do.
Yeah,
but he blends in like a sore thumb because his accent.
Yeah, plus he dresses up like if it's like you know the 19th century or something. But yeah, while this is all going on, we get a subplot where I thought this was pretty amazing. The Guardian and Superman go to a hippie party.
with the San Diego Five String Mob playing.
Yeah, they're pretty bizarre looking group of.
One looks like John Lennon.
Yeah, they have really weird futuristic instruments.
Well, the way he introduced them, I thought for sure that they were like from Apocalypse, because they've drawn hippies before, but these look like apocalyptic hippies.
Yeah, and they're not too excited to see Superman and Guardian there. But they're not the only strange-looking people, because Dubalex from the DNA Project, the purple alien with yellow horns, is there. And Superman calls him my favorite DNA alien. but yeah, he's there doing research, and he actually directs Superman to check out the floor with his X-ray vision and like kind of cues him into the fact that there's more going on at the party than they're just actually kind of Superman and Guardian are, I guess, are just there because this girl Terry Dean invited them, so they're just there to like as like a public service or something.
Yeah, she wanted Superman to dance, and like he's like, Superman don't dance.
Yeah. Like, I think I could do better public relations job just sitting here.
Machete, don't text. That's what it reminded me of.
Superman's a wallflower. But, yeah, when the gang gets to Scotland, they drop out of the plane in the whiz wagon, and they meet up with this guy, Felix McFinney, and he's the guy that has the Scottish accent. You've got the spirit, laddie, and the clothes, but somehow when you open your mouth, is who he's talking to, Scrapper, because Scrapper's dressed up in his Scottish outfit. And Scrapper says, easy there, Pops. I'm bending over scotch-wise to be me sweet self. Now just point the way to the master. So, we get a lot of that type of stuff going on. And,
he introduces his daughter. Business.
Yeah.
Guinea. She looks pretty hot.
Yeah.
Was that the chick with the white hair?
Yeah.
What's up with that? Her and Melody from Jersey and the Pussycats and Dove in the DC Universe and Clea from Doctor Strange. You never see any young chicks with white hair.
Felicia Hardy. Life. Black Cat.
Yeah, her too. I was going to say, you never see young chicks with white hair in real life.
Not young. I've seen old chicks.
Well, of course.
Yeah, maybe in superhero universe they have, that's the only place where they have scary monsters that are frightening enough to turn a whole head of hair white on a young lady.
Well, that would at least explain it.
That's my editorial explanation. But yeah, Ginny.
Stan Lee would say that was the only color we had that would come out good on the paper.
Yeah. I like my. I'm gonna submit mine for a no prize. But yeah, Ginny, supposedly, spoilers, is this guy's daughter. She's hanging out in a really short red skirt, and she's got, you know, it's cold up in Scotland, so even though her legs are exposed, she's got a little red winter cap on. But Scrapper's pretty impressed. He pulls his hat down over his ears and says, wow, what a chick.
He always is impressed. Him and Oberon. Oberon, like when he sees Big Barda in her bikini, he's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Why would somebody put her in this armor?
But he knows he's too young, so he tries to get Jimmy Olsen to hit on her.
And it's almost like he's saying it out loud. Like, hey, Jimmy, you need to score with her.
She's walking by. I think he is, because there's like 3 exclamation points at the end of each one of his sentences. So I don't think he's... I wouldn't expect Scrapper to be
so. Yeah, it's not 2 or 1. It's 3.
Yeah, Jimmy is answering in 2 and 1, so maybe he's talking a little bit quieter. Now that I pay attention to it, I think most sentences in this comic end in exclamation points. So
that was the thing.
Yeah.
That everybody did, and do you know the history of that? Why they did that? I don't.
I guess I've just always assumed it was, you know,
because periods didn't reproduce well in the printings, so that was why they mostly used the exclamation points.
But you could see the dot. You think a dot on the exclamation point comes out just fine. But you know the weird thing? This is very weird, is I've been reading comics since I was a kid, and I've never freaking noticed it until one day I was on a bowling team. And what I would do during when I'm not bowling is I was reading an old Captain America Jack Kirby issue, and one of the fellow bowlers was like, "Why are they always shouting?" And I'm like, I never had noticed it. It's like something, I guess, until somebody pointed it out. And then it's everywhere.
Yeah. Well, same thing here. I mean, I read this whole issue. I didn't really pay attention to the fact that... I mean, I kind of just read past it.
Yeah, you must have, because it's every issue in this book.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's one exclamation point. Sometimes they ended in a question. Never ended in a period. And it's if they really mean an exclamation, they might put 2. If they really, really want you to know about it, they'll put 3.
I think that's the way. I think 1 exclamation point I read as a period. 2 I read as...
regular voice?
Or like a regular exclamation point. And then 3 I read as shouting. So they're not shouting all the time, only when there's 3 exclamation points. That's the legend for this, to interpret it.
Put it in the spreadsheet.
Yeah. So they get to Locke Trevor, and as we said before, it's obviously Flippadippa's job to head on down and look for the monster, and he actually encounters another scuba diver who yanks his breather off of his face. There's actually someone else down there with him. And
his camera, because they were able to watch it.
Yeah.
What was going on.
So just as the rest of the Newsboy Legion up in the rafter, ready to come to his defense, it turns out that our Scottish friend and guide is a member of Intergang's Scottish branch.
But he doesn't know that Scrapper has his little paratrooper there. Scrapper Trooper. Scrapper Trooper takes a device which the guy put on there that supposedly shoots out a sound that would attract the Loch Ness monster, or the Loch Trevor monster.
Yeah. and I like that the Scrapper Trooper pretty much takes it upon himself to do it. It's not like anything that Scrapper asks him to do or anything. He just kind of creeps. They're all being held at gunpoint, so he creeps down Scrapper's back and goes off and basically saves the day on his own. And, you know, this actually causes the Loch Trevor monster to appear and capsize their raft, which allows them to escape. And fortunately, you know, the Scrapper Trooper manages to climb up onto Scrapper's crazy Scottish hat and use it as a flotation device so he doesn't drown.
But, what's the deal with Scrapper Trooper anyway? Who created him? Where is he from?
Project Catamus was creating clones, and they were they create clones of all of these characters, but they also have clones of aliens. They're actually splicing alien DNA with human DNA and creating other, just like a duplex. That's how Duplex came about. But there's a whole bunch of Scrapper Troopers, and this one has appeared in many issues because Scrapper always carries it around in his pocket. And that's like his secret weapon, because the only people that know about it are the Newsboy Legion and Jimmy Olsen. The villains never know about it because that's their like secret weapon. He just pull him out of his pocket and he'll go take care of business.
And he never talks. What did Scrapper had his voice box removed?
Yeah, he never says anything. It's almost like they can almost communicate by just looking at each other, the way they work.
Or maybe just too small to hear him. But, well, we wrap things up with, it turns out that the person who confronted Flipper Dipper under the water and took his breather was Ginny, the beautiful Scottish lass.
With white hair.
So, unfortunately, she's not actually the guy's daughter. They're both just members of Intergang pretending. And one thing we did...
Silver Sable's another one. There's a lot of white-haired women.
Yeah.
That are hot. I mean, Aunt May has white hair, but I wouldn't consider her hot or young.
No.
We do get to see her have sex every now and then, though, with their new husband.
I don't believe they brought her back to life after they had the good sense to finally kill her. And then for her to get married on top of that.
Yeah, get married and have sex. And then have Peter have to see J. Jonah Jameson's dad.
Didn't Peter walk in on them having sex one time?
Yeah, he sure did. That's awkward.
I was going to say, I guess that would be pretty traumatic.
It's probably hard to figure out what's a wrinkle and what's not.
Have any of you happened to walk in on your parents having sex?
Thank God, no.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Yeah, no.
I'm so glad.
Not, yeah.
It's probably happened to a lot of people, though, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it happens like maybe when, you know, kids are little and they don't know better to not open that closed door. But no, I'm satisfied with, you know, I have a sister, so I have to assume it's occurred twice, and that's all the information I'm interested in knowing.
It's only happened twice, yeah.
At least, and that's all I need to know. But
unless you were cloned.
Yes. For all I know, I'm I'm a Chris Trooper.
Yeah.
And there's actually like a giant version of me somewhere. Or maybe this whole world is just
giant version of you with white hair.
Yeah. There's just a big, I'm just living, this whole world is just a big pocket. in the pants of the real Chris.
And every now and then somebody puts their hand in the pocket.
Yeah.
Jiggles you around.
Lifts me out and I break some machinery, make some explosions, and then go back in.
Yeah.
But one thing I didn't want to skip over is the last we see of the subplot in this issue is the five members of the San Diego five-string mob all blow on their instruments at the same time, blow or strum or bang, whatever happens to be the case, and it turns out they have...
Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Wow, I lost internet.
Oh, okay.
I so, thought it was...
Were you guys still connected?
No. I eventually got Chris back. I thought it was my computer again.
No, it was mine. I think my router is giving out. It seems like every time... Either that or I need a firmware update, because it seems like every time that my wife runs the TV, you know, Netflix instant streaming, it seems to like knock out the internet. I don't know why it does that. As soon as she's done watching it, it's not like it's during.
Oh, really? It's not during? Because I was going to say...
Because she was watching Sons of Anarchy, and then she went upstairs, and all of a sudden... Bang! I just went, knocked it out.
I thought it was the San Diego five-string mob. So I was talking about him and Bear Boy. As soon as I made the sound effect from Bear Boy's horn,
I missed the sound effect.
Yeah, as soon as I said, "Wong," the internet exploded. I thought I had created.
You thought you have the anti-life equation. Equation, you're like, oh shit, I'm like Sunny Sumu.
I destroyed the internet. Working for Apocalypse, and I don't even mean to.
But now everything is really clear, so maybe it was my internet that was killing you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was always hearing you, Chris, but I know we were killing Trenchcoat every now and then.
Yup.
Well, I guess that kind of... We were kind of wrapping that up, at least, anyways. That's a... You know where we were at when it happened.
All right. So we had a miscellaneous topic, Trenchcoat. I don't know if you'll be able to do these off the fly, but we were going to pick our top five albums or CDs or cassettes or 8-tracks, whatever you were into, of all time.
I can definitely do that. My top CD would be the Velvet Underground and Nico from 67.
Ah.
Cool.
Nice.
And in second place is London Calling by The Clash.
That's definitely one of my favorites.
I was going to say third place, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars by Bowie. Fourth and fifth place, I'll have to think about.
Oh, why don't you think about them while we shout out our first three?
Those are some great choices. Those are all albums that I like and I'm familiar with.
I'm not too familiar with David Bowie.
Bowie's great. At least he was back in the 70s.
Yeah, I hear it every now and then on Pandora, like some of his stuff, but I don't know like what album. I never pay attention. I'm like listening to Pandora. I put in this topic like 80s punk and new wave or something, and I get like old Bowie every now and then, and I don't know where it comes from. I don't pay attention to album it came from, but I like what I hear.
Yeah.
And I hear The Clash all the time. I'm not too familiar with the Velvet Underground.
Oh, you got to at least hear that one album I mentioned, because that's awesome from beginning to end.
Right on.
Definitely.
Well, my top one, and I don't know if it was like the year after I was born, but I think it's my top one because my mom used to play it, I guess, when I was really young, like for years and years and years and years until I hit age six. And I think it was an 8-track. The reason it was an 8-track is because we didn't buy a lot of albums because we had an 8-track player in the car and then an 8-track player on the stereo. And at the time, 8-tracks were more portable. They didn't sound...
Chris...
They sounded horrible.
Are you even... I was going to say to Chris, are you even old enough to remember 8-tracks?
I never... Like, we never had them in the house. I saw them around when I was a kid because my grandpa's truck when I was a kid still had a 8-track player in it. So they used to have, my grandparents had 8-tracks and still used them when I was a kid. So I saw them there, but that's it.
I wonder why they called it 8-track, because it was like a 4-track. No, it was like program 1, program 2, program 3, program
4. And you had to turn it over and over to play every side?
Yeah, until the more modern ones that were able to just go by the programs.
Yeah. No, I mean, as far
but,
as...
But you could never control, like, they're like sectioned off by 3 songs, and then you're like, you could never control, unless it was the beginning of the first program 2, or track 2, or whatever you want to call it. If you hit the little button and went over, you would hear the first song in that section, but you could never control, like, fast forward or stuff through that stuff. It was, you'd have to listen to everything back in the day. It wasn't like a record player where you could just lift it up. And I think that's why 8-tracks, one thing about in my time, you didn't just like download a file and listen to one song. You listened to the whole album. Mm-hmm. And you almost knew, like, song. You could the first end of the first song would happen. You knew the second song would be playing.
You'd start, yeah. Or
you're,
if you heard that
programmed.
Song,
yeah. Radio, it was like
you'd start to hear the next song in your head, even if it,
yeah,
it's on the radio.
So based on that, it's still one of my favorite. All of these are like in my top favorites, and it's mostly because I've heard them so many damn times. And I don't get sick of them, but it's the Beatles' Let It Be that my parents used to play it all the freaking time. Mm. And it's got my favorite Beatles songs on there.
Oh, okay.
What's your favorite Beatles song?
Believe it or not, it's Across the Universe or with that French term in it. I just dig that song. And it's on that song.
I thought Let It Be was a letdown after Abbey Road, though.
Yeah, I think my Beatles exploration was very limited. Do you know what I mean? It was limited by... I was introduced to whatever I had, that my parents had, and they didn't have Abbey Road. So I like heard that many, many years later.
I actually started out, my dad had, they had put out those 2 double albums of, they were CDs of Beatles. There was like a red one, which was the early part of their career, and the blue one, that was the later part of their career.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like four CDs altogether, and he got those, and I used to listen to those a lot, and then that's what kind of got me into them for the first time. And, you know, eventually I sought out some of the actual albums and at one point got a record player and took a bunch of his old records because he didn't really use them anymore. And eventually kind of Abbey Road ended up becoming my personal favorite.
Yeah, I think Let It Be was just because of repetitive. That's what they used to put on for me to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So it's like, I know, it's like, it's nap time, let's put some Let It Be. And then that had like a negative effect towards the end of my childhood when my grandma would play Elton John over and over again, and I got so sick of Elton John that I don't like him to this day. It's weird. So it had the opposite effect of Let It Be, but I like Hey Jude a lot. I like The Long and Winding Road and Across the Universe, and I think it's just because I've heard it so many damn times. It's the only Beatles that I own an album. I still have the 8-track, believe it or not. I just don't have anything that'll play it. and the 8-tracks deteriorate. I mean, that tape doesn't last very long. At least in my experience, I've tried to play it. And I have it in cassette, and I have it in CD, so I have it like in all forms. What's one of yours, Chris?
You know, I guess the approach I took, because I went through so many, even starting out as a little kid, I went through so many different phases growing up of types of music I listened to and stuff, and like I would switch and stop listening to a certain kind of music and totally switch to another, and until I got to be an adult and kind of like I just kind of listened to a whole variety of things. So I didn't really do like my favorites of all time as if I would consider them now. I kind of grouped them by period, or like wrote down a few that I could remember from different periods. And what was kind of weird was when I was real little, like I'm talking about like 5, 6 years old, like elementary school, some of my first memories are listening to music because my dad played a lot of music. And I mean, the only real kiddie music I remember listening to a lot was the Alvin and the Chipmunks Christmas album. She actually had as an it was actually a record. These were like all records and tapes. But then some of the other ones I would listen to a lot were my dad's stuff. I would listen to the Footloose soundtrack a lot. And a couple other ones, for some reason, it's not really, I don't know if most people consider it a great album, but I listened to Genesis's Invisible Touch over and over again. I think it was only side A, and to this day, like if I put it on, I could probably sing along
the whole album. Side. Yeah,
yeah. That and Tears for Fears was pretty big. And
was it the one with Shout and
yeah.
Everybody Wants to Rule the World?
Yep. Yeah, Songs from the Big Chair, I think it's called.
Yeah, I was a fan of that, and then I grew out of that like album. I mean, there's a couple that I still like Mother's Talk or whatever. I forget what it's called. But, like, the two big ones, like Shout and Everybody Wants to Rule the World, if that comes on, my wife wants to hear it, and I just like, hit fast forward or hit, you know, the next song.
Yeah. The funny thing I always remember about Shout is that, it was a pretty popular song. It was on the radio all the time then, and, like, me and the kids in the neighborhood, we used to... Instead of, because it goes, shout, let it all out. And we used to change shout to fart, so it was fart, fart, let it all out.
Speaking of farts, man, Harley had gas yesterday, and it was bad because she'd, like, fart and it'd stink, and then she'd look at me like I did it. It was weird. She'd like always give me like this look, and then after she farted the third time, she looked at me, and she was like asleep. She'd like fart, it would wake her up, and then she'd like smell it, and then she'd like look at me, and then she'd leave the chair. Like, why do you keep farting?
What did you do, Dad?
Yeah.
What did you do? I'm trying to sleep here.
Trying to sleep, and it's stinking up the place. They were awful farts. They smelled like Sugar Smacks. You know that cereal?
Ooh.
It was awful.
I mean, Sugar Smacks cereal is not bad, but I can't.
But the smell of it mixed with the fart is not good.
Combined with a dog's ass, that doesn't sound very good. So, Trenchcoat, did you think of some other ones?
Yeah, I did actually. Because you brought up the Beatles, I was going to say, in fourth place, I have to say the White Album, because even though it's a double album, it's great from beginning to end, all four sides. And in fifth place, I have to say the Sex Pistols. Never mind the bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols.
Road Runner, Road Runner! I like that album too. I'm a fan of the Sex Pistols, but I didn't discover the Sex Pistols until I watched Sid and Nancy.
Oh, really?
That was long after the Sex Pistols. Like, I watched
that
the movie.
That was a great movie, though.
Yeah, I had a friend. I was more into the new wave at the time in high school, and he was a punker. Like, he would wear the combat boots, and he'd go slam dancing. And I even went with him once and then never again because I got the shit kicked out of me. I was bleeding, bloody. I was like, what the fuck is this? How is this fun? But he took me to this small theater because at the time it was an artsy-fartsy movie and it wasn't showing at the big theaters. And I went to see Sid and Nancy and I was like, God, that's fucking awesome. That movie was awesome. Like, it was... Who's the actor in it? It was the guy
Gary
that's
Oldman.
Gary Oldman from, you know, he's Commissioner Gordon now. But he was freaking awesome in there. And he actually sang, I believe, a lot of the Sid Vicious tunes. And I bought that soundtrack, and then I went to discover their albums, and I ended up buying a few of them. But, yeah, it's a cool album.
Yeah, that was a high school album for me. Like the 90s. I think I went and saw Sid and Nancy because of, you know, because I was into punk and stuff in high school.
It introduced me to PIL too, because that they were a band around the time of Sid and Nancy movie, which was Johnny Rotten, and sex is boring, Sidney. It's boring, boring, boring. I remember
that
from the
guy
movie.
Played Johnny Rotten in the movie was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The only PIL song I can even think of, though, is This Is Not a Love Song.
This Is Not a Love Song, EMI. I remember. EMI? Or maybe I'm getting...
That was the Sex Pistols.
Oh, okay, I'm getting confused. I think he re-released a couple of them.
Probably.
And there's one called Black and White that I hear all the time, but... I know he was trying to sue that guy from Information Society because he started to mimic his look, even though the music style was kind of different. So the next few of them are grouped. The albums that I had were grouped very close together. So like the Beatles was 1970, and then I go to the 80s, like 1980, 81, 85, and 83. And I think that was the time when I was like, we'd go on these long vacations. My family would do the family truckster, just like my dad was a lot like Chevy Chase. We would get in the truckster and then travel all the way across country and go visit the biggest ball of twine on the way to get to Disney World or whatever. That was us. One of the albums that I heard so many freaking times, and I still love it. I even saw them recently in concert, was REO Speedwagon, High Infidelity. I was really, really big into that band. That was from 1980.
I don't ever... What are some of their big songs? I mean, I
keep
heard
on
of them, but...
You.
Oh, okay.
Heard it from a friend who... Don't Let Him Go. I mean, there's a whole bunch of songs from that. I think those were the only three. Maybe there's four that were released as singles that were popular in that. But it definitely was like their best. I think it was their best-selling album ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely heard some have heard those on like classic rock and stuff.
You Have to Hear Keep on Loving You. That's like their
Yeah, and Heard It From a Friend. Yeah, like those I've heard on classic rock and stuff.
And I remember on the album, they had a clip from the Little Rascals. I think it was Don't Let Him Go right before that song. It was a little clip about the He-Man Woman Haters Club. And I always, every time that song is played on the radio to this day, I hear the Little Rascals right before it. It's a bizarre thing. You got
no, I never. Yeah, so once I started kind of buying my own tapes, and, you know, going to the mall and buying cassettes, much to my chagrin, now I did go through a hair metal phase. I think I was still in elementary school, so it's kind of bizarre to me. You know, I listened to and a lot of stuff that I don't think I really understood when I was a kid, but some of the ones that at the time I really liked were Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue, Open Up and Say Ah by Poison, and Warrant's Dirty, Rotten, Filthy, Stinking Rich.
Yeah, so funny you how went from Alvin and the Chipmunks to hair metal.
Yeah, it's the beginning of a bizarre journey. It's just beginning at this point through all kinds of music for me. But yeah, I guess it was just popular at the time. I mean, like, I remember my babysitter, I was real into Bon Jovi, and, you know, that was like when he was really popular for the first time, and was like Slippery When Wet and stuff. And I mean, it's all packed with like sexual innuendo, and I had no idea, you know. But I listened to him over and over again.
That was actually one of my first concerts. One of my first concerts was Bryan Adams. And then after Bryan Adams, I went to a Rat and Bon Jovi concert, and Rat was the premier group, and Bon Jovi opened for Rat. So it was like when Bon Jovi's first album came out. I think Runaway was a song. Ooh, she's a little runaway. Yeah, so, yeah, I like Bon Jovi, but believe it or not, my favorite Bon Jovi album is from the Young Guns 2 soundtrack. He did the whole soundtrack, and it's freaking awesome.
That's the one that has the cowboy song on it, right?
Yeah. Well, not Wanted. Wanted's from something else, but...
Oh, it is.
Yeah, this one didn't have... It might have had one song hit the radio, but none of the others did. But Young Guns was like a big movie for me, because I loved it. Even the second one I loved. But William H. Bonney, you are not a god. Well, why don't you pull the trigger and find out? I just love that movie.
I've seen them, but I haven't seen them since way back when.
So now, I did mine in according to years. So my third one is Foreigner 4. I'm a huge Foreigner fan, and when that album hit, I just I loved it. Like Jukebox Hero, I still can know every word to that song. And Urgent, I love Urgent, and the Waiting for a Girl Like You. But I like all the other songs that are on the album as well. So I'm a big fan of Lou Gramm and Foreigner.
Jukebox Hero is a cool song.
Yeah.
It's a good one. Waiting for a Girl Like You, that's another one that you, pretty much everyone that exists has heard that a million times.
Yeah.
Can't escape it.
And I'm going to throw in one more just because you're throwing in some. Because it's in the same time period. Journey Escape.
Oh, yeah.
Love that one.
Foreigner and Journey go hand in hand.
Yeah, they kind of go hand in hand. Foreigner, Journey, and Styx. I don't know why I think of them all together, but those are bands I like a lot.
Well, either, like, right after... So, talk about switching things up. I went from... listening to hair metal to listening to hip hop. I guess I was just following whatever was popular. I don't know, but I said before on the podcast I used to tape videos off of Rhapsody and stuff. And so these, I'm a little more proud to say that I listened to back when I was a kid, and still I mean, I don't really care for the hair metal anymore, but as an adult, I still like a lot of the hip-hop albums I listen to. I was, like, my big one was Public Enemy, and Fear of a Black Planet was still an album I really like, and another one was Tribe Called Quest and Low End Theory. And LL Cool J, Mama Said Knock You Out were some of the ones that I thought of. But, yeah, I mean, there's still, that actually was a phase, like, I'll skip over this, but, like, when I got into middle school and stuff, I still listened to some hip-hop, but that was one period in my life where I listened to, like, the local, like, pop radio and listened to, like, a lot of what was, like, popular with other kids at school and stuff. Yeah. And a lot of it doesn't stand up nowadays, but looking back to, like, pre-high school, there isn't a lot that stands up, but like some of the hip hop I listened to and I was lucky enough to be exposed to, I still stands up.
Yeah, hair metal though did make the best stripper music. You ever been to a strip club? Hair metal's the best music to see a stripper strip to.
A lot of the songs were probably written like at strip clubs. Or at least on the strip.
Yeah.
Strip.
All right. The next one I had is another hair band, Def Leppard, Pyromania. I just heard that album so many times. I don't think it's my favorite, but I kind of just, the way I did my album picks are the ones that came to mind the very quickest. Like ones that I've heard so many freaking times that, and I still hear today. And I when it comes on the digital, the iPod, I still listen to them a lot. But Pyromania from 1983, big fan of that.
Isn't that the band with the one-armed drummer?
Yeah, and Joe Elliott. Matter of fact, I follow him on Facebook. They were playing a concert last night.
Nice.
Yeah, he'd gotten, and I don't know them all by name except for Joe Elliott, and I know that guy got in a car accident, lost his arm, and then he wasn't drumming for a while, but then he learned to drum fairly effectively with his feet and his one arm that is functioning, and they kept him in the band, which I think is cool.
Yeah, I think he set up like extra pedals and stuff and did like a lot more with his feet than normal drummers do.
Right.
Which is, I mean, they do a lot to begin with, but... And I think that they... There was a handful of bands, and I think Def Leppard was one of them, that sort of like latched on to the hair metal craze for popularity's sake and stuff, but like they had been around a bit longer than a lot of these bands that popped up and were a little bit more, I think you can like credit them in some of their albums as like a little bit more legitimate rock, like standing the test of the time a bit better because of that, you know. I mean, for me in high school, I think I thought that because there were four grades that I had to reinvent myself for each one of them.
Did you actually dress the fad? Like, did you have a long hair, heavy metal look at one time?
Well, no, I mean, when I was a kid, no. I mean, but these other phases, like, I just kind of, I don't even know, I think I just, didn't purposely dress in any particular way until, like, I got to middle school for a little while. I tried to, like, kind of wear what was popular, and then towards the end of middle school, I was dressed like a skater, even though I could never even really ollie. But in high school, I kind of went through different phases of like
a skateboard dude, or what? What
do you mean? Yeah, like skateboard,
or just like a roller skates.
Oh no, yeah, skateboard.
Like you wore your '70s shirt and your collar up.
Yeah, I was like a
Keith Knutson
prototype. Yeah, I was not prototype. Actually, I would have been like a follower of the Keith Knutson style. Tube socks pulled up to my knees. No, I was like skateboarding. I had some friends that legitimately could skateboard. I always was terrible at it, and
But did you try? Did you
kind of took the look of it? Yeah, I tried some. I had like a skateboard for a little while.
Did you just get basics frustrated.
I mean, I'd ride it around, but I couldn't even, like, the basics, like, the first thing you learn how to do is to ollie to, like, you know, jump and make the skateboard jump.
Yeah.
I could never, like, really pull that off consistently and would just get frustrated and go back inside and play more video games. That was kind of the story of my childhood. Try something physically strenuous for a little while, briefly, and then get frustrated and go play some more.
With every sport, I just get frustrated and I'm back in the video games.
Yeah. Like, wait a minute. If I get further along in this baseball sport, they're going to take the ball off of this tee and throw it at me? Fuck that. I'm going. But, so I had like a punk phase and like. But I kind of started out a little bit like darker with like industrial and goth and stuff. And at one point, you know, my favorite band in the universe was The Cure.
Oh, same here.
So I listened. I mean, I had literally at the time, I think, Wish was the most recent album. But I mean, had like I ended up getting like everything that they put out. And I wrote down Disintegration just because that's probably their best album.
When I started dating Barb in high school, that's kind of when I became a huge Cure fan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, they definitely still have
Cure and Depeche Mode and all the...
Yeah, I listened to Depeche Mode around then and Smiths and stuff like that. And the other thing I was into like right around the same time, beginning of high school... was nine.
Did you say crap, Michael?
Did
about
I say
the Smiths?
No, I love the Smiths.
Oh, okay. Because I like the Smiths.
I even follow Morrissey to this day. I have all of his CDs. I find them very unique in their lyrics because it's such a bizarre group to listen to because their lyrics are horrid. But I mean, they're really dark and twisted where the beat is uppity. It's usually like
I like their lyrics
in a coma, I know. It's like something you could dance to. Well, and it's like good Lord. And then hairdresser on
there is a light that never goes out on fire, yeah.
I mean, what does that mean that you go to a hairdresser and your place caught on fire? I mean, I just don't.
Yeah, that's I think the kind of the hook is the contrast between.
And then there's the if a double decker bus came crashing into us. I mean, like
that's awesome.
What the fuck? No, I love
to die by your side, etc. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Smiths. My wife, not so much. I think she likes more of the later Morrissey stuff than the Smiths. But I have, like, their two archives. I enjoy listening to those.
I think that's
why... I don't think I've ever heard Morrissey except his first solo album.
Oh, it's good stuff. And he didn't change. His lyrics are still fucked up. It's like you're singing this tune and then you're listening to what you're singing and you're like, good God, these are awful lyrics.
Yeah, I think that kind of guarantees that the Smiths will always be popular with every generation of college students. That like contrast of, you know, just ultra depressive lyrics.
Well, like, The Cure is like a goth band, you know, with Robert Smith, but their lyrics are not bad. Do you know what I mean?
No.
They're not goth lyrics.
Not as, yeah.
Even though he looks goth, his lyrics are not.
Well,
As opposed to most goth bands, they were actually good.
And and they did definitely have, I mean, they had a period early on that was darker, but even musically kind of, I would say that they kind of were goth, but in the sense that they sort of leaned more towards like the dark beauty kind of side of things, but they took a poppier approach to music with just kind of more ornate arrangements and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, some of that stuff stands up for me. The other thing at the time was like industrial, and I kind of, you know, I got into Nine Inch Nails, and in kind of a weird way, actually, like my friend in eighth grade, he was into like old, like he was into like B movies and stuff, and we watched like, it was like Class of 1984 or something like that it was called, but like Head Like a Hole from Nine Inch Nails' Pretty Hate Machine was the song that played over the credits.
Class of 1984? The only Class of is Nukem High. Class of Nukem High from Trauma Films.
Right.
I actually went through a phase where I went through a trauma phase. I watched every Toxic Avenger, Street Trash, Class of Nukem High.
See, it's not.
Did you ever see
Romeo and Juliet?
Did you ever see Poltergeist?
No, not Poltergeist. That came later, I think. After I was leaving.
That's the only trauma movie I ever saw. I never caught the Toxic Avenger movies.
It's a bizarre genre. Like he locked into it. It was very sexual and very violent. And it was very weird. In other words, the characters were just it was anarchy, is what it was.
I did see the oldest trauma movie. I think it was called Bloodsucking Freaks, and that was awesome.
I haven't seen that one. I've seen. I know what the cover looks like, because I was huge into horror, and I would walk into the video store, and I know which cover Bloodsucking Freaks looks like. I just
want to say, Human Centipede 2 sucked. It was nowhere as awesome as the first one.
I agree. It was going more for shock than what I thought was a Dr. Frankenstein sick, twisted story in the first one.
Well, at least this one had a human millipede with, like, I think 12 people.
Yeah, Human Centipede when the guy poops. That's a funny scene.
That was so great. And the girl had to swallow it.
Yeah. He's like, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. I got Keith to watch that movie.
You did?
Yeah. Human Centipede. Not the second one. I didn't have him watch the second one. The second one's very, very different.
I haven't seen either of them, but I know pretty much what happens in the first movie.
It's because we described it in ultimate detail, probably.
Yeah. I think you'd... Yeah, and I've another podcast I've heard. I don't know what movie it was. It wasn't Class of 1984, because that came out in 1982. And that was obviously way before Pretty Hate Machine even came out, but... but regardless, I was into them.
I got into them.
They got like super popular.
But mostly from my brother. My brother's 3 years younger, and I guess he turned me on to them when they were, you know, because he was listening to different music than me, and that's one album that he turned me on to and I liked. He also turned me on to Morrissey. Like, I always loved the Smiths, but didn't follow Morrissey when he left the Smiths. Mm-hmm. And then he turned me on to them later in college, so I became a Morrissey junkie.
Nice.
My last one is The Outfield, Play Deep. I've always been a fan of this band, and another band I own every CD and album, even though I don't think they've ever hit big except for Play Deep. They might have had one single come out of their next one, but after that, they kind of just didn't play them on the radio, but I kept buying their albums, and I have them all loaded onto iTunes.
Yeah, what was their big song?
Your Love. Don't Want to Use Your Love Tonight.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Every Time You Cry was a big hit, and can't remember. Say It Ain't So was the other one. The rest of them were big hits to me, but they never played them on the radio.
There was a different Say It Ain't So that was popular when I was in high school. That was by Weezer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I am a Weezer fan now. Weezer's weird for me, though, because I could, like, really like one album, and then they come out with another one, and I don't like it, and then they come out with another one, and I really like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard for me to just say I'm going to buy it sight unseen.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't really continued to follow them. I still really love their first two albums, which are the ones that, you know, I remember from back then, but I haven't really kept up with them, but I still like the first two a lot. I mean, finishing mine up, later parts of high school, I kind of was more into punk and indie. Some of the punk stuff, you know, I could take or leave today, but there's stuff that's kind of stayed with me. Of course, I mean, how could I not like Operation Ivy? they were a favorite. Minor Threat was a favorite. I heard The Clash for the first time, and you know, Trenchcoat mentioned London Calling. I would still consider that one probably one of my top 10 still. I was big into like Sonic Youth and Pavement. I still like them. And the last one I'll mention is that towards the end of high school, I was driving home from somewhere sometime, and I happened to hear a song on the radio, and I liked ska a fair bit too in high school.
That's a band that I just discovered recently, a ska or a genre that I love. Oh, and yeah. I'd never seen a ska band. I've never seen one. And I think they would be so live. I think that would be such a fun thing to watch.
Oh, definitely.
Because the horns are just nuts, I mean, on some of the songs.
Yeah, we went to a lot of ska shows in high school. I had friends that were in a band that kind of did, like, punk and ska.
Mm-hmm.
And, but yeah, so I was driving home and I heard a song that kind of had a ska influence to it, or ska feel to it. And it turned out to be Watching the Detectives by Elvis Costello.
Ah.
And so I was like, I got to get whatever album that song was on. And it just so happened that it was his first album, My Aim Is True, which came out all the way back in 1977. And it was probably like 96 or 97 when I heard it. So it was like 20 years old. But that started like a love of Elvis Costello that still continues today. I mean, probably is that album's one of my favorites, definitely in top five. And like, he's probably my favorite artist to this day. So that kind of started when I was a senior in high school, probably. So that kind of wraps up all the shit that I was going to say, but I could mention phases in different music and shit.
Yes,
that I like.
We'll have to delve into more of it because I just touched the surface. I just skimmed it.
Yeah, we could like specify like a year or something like that.
Sure.
You know?
Because I did the same thing you did. The only genre I think I've never ever gotten into except for maybe one or two songs is rap. Never got into it. Until I saw Keith Knutson rap the Beastie Boys, then that changed my life.
We used to do that, and me and these two other kids used to do that in the back of our biology class in 10th grade. We used to do Beastie Boys songs, and there's three of them, and there was three of us, so we would, like, do it, act it out when we were, like, supposed to be paying attention to class.
Yeah. But AC/DC was big, too, for me, and Van Halen.
Ah.
And I even followed Van Halen when David Lee Roth left. Like, I was a huge Sammy Hagar fan, so it kind of just felt like Sammy Halen. But, and AC/DC, I have every one of them loaded on iTunes, and I still like their, even the new stuff that comes out. They seem to be popular now in commercials and Iron Man.
Yeah.
It's like,
I didn't listen to them back in the day, but I definitely, like, have appreciation for them nowadays. I have a few of their albums. Like, Back in Black is awesome, and just start to finish, it's, like, really good, like, bar music.
Yeah.
Drinking metal. But, good stuff.
Yep. And I don't know if you want to do questions. Do you want to do questions really quick? We have quite a few, or do you want to save them for next time?
We could do a few, or...
All right, let's...
Do a couple or something, or just...
I just need to find them. You have one on your wall, right?
Yeah, I know what that one was. That was,
Why don't you ask it?
Mark asked, what our favorite series published by First Comics was. I think he gave me a link to a list of their comics and stuff. I mean, for me, I've said on the show how I didn't read much indie comics when I was back in the day, so for me, you know, I'm just starting to, even for this podcast, check out some of that stuff, so this could change eventually, but you know, right now is for me, it's John Sable, because you know, that's what I've read the most of, John Sable Freelance, which I've talked about on the show. But I know that First, you know, also published Nexus and Grimjack, neither of which I've read much of.
American Flag
and Badger. Yeah. So would American Flag be yours?
Yeah. Hands down.
Yeah, I still need to read a lot of that stuff, so it could change, but
yeah, I'm in the same boat. I was gonna say Star Slayer, but that was Eclipse. Star Slayer was a sci-fi one that introduced the Rocketeer, but that's not even the same company. So I'm going to have to go with John Sable because of sheer quantity of what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
I've also read some E-Man. I've never read American Flag. I've never read Badger.
As an incentive for you to read American Flag, Alan Moore wrote a backup series about sex. That was awesome.
In which one?
In like issues 20 through 26, I think, or 25.
Huh. I can't believe I haven't read it because I would say I'm a huge Howard Chaykin fan. Like, I've read almost everything that he's done from, at least from the 90s forward. I haven't read this, obviously. It's from the 80s, but I think from the 90s forward, I've read most of his stuff. Like, I'm currently reading Black Kiss 2, which is a nasty book, but... I liked his Blade. I like his art style. Like, people always podcast about good and bad Chaykin, and I've always liked Chaykin. So it's probably a hardcover or a collection that I'd like to check. Grimjack, I've read a lot. That was John Ostrander, but I wouldn't say it's my favorite because I've just dipped my toe in it. And Nexus, the same thing. Maybe one issue I've read of it. I have a couple issues of Warp, but I've never read them.
I have a feeling, from what I've seen of Nexus, that it could be a favorite of mine. I'm definitely going to check that out at some point. I'm pretty. That's one of the things I kind of discovered through the podcast. Is I'm pretty into some of the stuff that they've published, so I look forward to checking out more.
Well, didn't you read the Chronicles of Quorum?
Yeah, I read the first. I did talk about the first couple issues. That was first too. And those were definitely good. Because they did. That's Keith's. I mean, it's an adaptation of Keith's guy. Michael Moorcock.
He loves that cock.
Yeah. That's an adaptation of one of his stories. I know it was Mike Mignola on the art. I think it was it Mike Barr that wrote it? But I know Mark also had another question. I think you posted this one on your...
Can you find it on my wall? Because I can't find shit on my wall. All I see is pictures of Harlequin.
I'll see if I can find the other ones, but I know one of the ones that one of the ones that he asked also was our favorite DC Marvel intercompany crossover before the 90s. Which for me is pretty... Trenchcoat actually mentioned it earlier. Mine by far is X-Men Teen Titans.
Yeah, I hate to be to copy everybody, but I'd have to say the same because I never got to read Spider-Man versus Superman or is this considered an intercompany crossover, Muhammad Ali versus Superman?
No, I mean that was just pretty much
what
DC,
would the
I
second
think.
Company be?
Muhammad Ali. They have to play for his rights, right? I mean, but...
Actually, one thing that's funny about that is I mentioned way back that I read an interview with Jeanette Kahn in Back Issue Magazine, and they actually talk about that because she had the idea to, you know, put a bunch of celebrity faces in the crowd of that Neil Adams cover. And they went ahead and did it and then realized that they needed to get the rights for the likenesses of all the people that they put in there. So they were running around like crazy at the last second, just getting, like trying to get some of these people that Neil Adams had drawn into the crowd to just like volunteer their rights. Like they really couldn't pay them or anything. And fortunately, a lot of people were cool with it, but they did have to like take out, I don't know who, but they had to take out some people that... they weren't allowed to use. It was kind of a faux, like a little bit of a mix-up on their part.
Yeah, I'm going to go with X-Men Teen Titans. That was by far my favorite. Did you have one, Trenchcoat?
That would be mine, too. To copy myself, that comic also had great Walt Simonson art.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to beat it. It was unlike anything that came before, and there haven't been a lot to compare with it since as far as, I mean, both properties were at the top of their game. I mean, I was only 3 when it came out. I obviously didn't read it back then, but just like the thrill of seeing Cyclops and Dick Grayson shake hands and Darkseid and Dark Phoenix together, I mean, just... So amazing, but just seeing those, that classic X-Men team and classic Teen Titans team, you know, working together, it's just too bad. I mean, if they were going to do a second one, which would have been by, you know, Marv Wolfman and George Perez as a follow-up, it's just a shame that that never happened.
Surprised you didn't say Deathmate.
I think he said... Pre-90s. That's the only reason I didn't
say
that.
Oh, pre-90s. Okay.
It's a shame they never got to do JLA Avengers back then when they had the chance to the first time. They eventually did that in the 90s, though.
Yeah, That was a good series, too. Matter of fact, it ties into our Kronos talk. That was one of the villains of that series. Kronos. With the K. It wasn't the guy. I found it.
Okay. I guess we could do, just a couple more, maybe.
Yeah. Donnie's is kind of... Donnie Salvo gave us, favorite comics, TV shows when you were kids. I think we're covering that, as main topics, like we did the albums. So we might take some of that and make it a topic in the future.
That's a summary of our show.
Yeah, Kyle Henry is old Marvel Cosmic versus new Marvel Cosmic. I'll go with new Marvel Cosmic because I wasn't a big fan of the Silver Surfer back in the day, other than what was in Fantastic Four, and I didn't like Guardians when they first came out.
Oh! Because that was great with the Steve Gerber writing?
Yeah, I think I only read one issue. I think I read the one that didn't appear in its own title, or it was in Marvel Feature, or what was it in? I can't remember.
It was in Marvel Presents.
Okay.
The Guardians.
Yeah.
And they were the real Guardians as opposed to these guys running around now. Peter Quill and Rocket Raccoon and those guys.
And Groot.
Groot.
I am Groot.
I don't know. For me, it's just kind of a default thing because I guess I'm thinking of New Cosmic as Annihilation and all that stuff. I haven't read any of that stuff, so it's got to be old for me. And by old, I'm thinking of, for me, old is what I read when I was a kid, which was Infinity Gauntlet and Ron Lim, Silver Surfer and stuff.
Quasar.
Quasar, yeah. But it's really just
Adam Warlock.
Yeah, I never read Adam Warlock when I was a kid, but I do like Jim Starlin nowadays. But
are you talking about the Adam Warlock prior to the Infinity Gauntlet, or the one that came after with Adam Warlock?
Prior.
What was it called in the Infinity Gems or Infinity Watch?
Yeah, Adam Warlock and Infinity Watch. That was old, newer.
I was talking about the 70s Warlock.
Well, was that good? Is that worth reading?
It was awesome. Because it was written and drawn by Starlin.
Mm-hmm.
And Warlock basically kills himself. It was a whole thing. Because he was also he was going to turn into the Magus, a bad guy in his future. So that wouldn't happen, he kills himself. And the story picks up from there.
And then he's resurrected. I think he died even again later on in the new Marvel Cosmic.
That's what he does best.
Comes back to life.
It's like Jean Grey.
Yeah. This one, I can't really participate because I don't think I've ever done this, but it says, how old were you when you first discovered Monty Python?
I've never been
probably. Good.
No, I was just saying I was never a huge Monty Python guy. I did watch them some. I think maybe the first time I saw them was in high school, probably, or saw, the big, what the hell is it called? The movie that everybody quotes. I'm drawing a blank.
Where he cuts his arms off. The Holy Grail.
And Holy Grail, yeah. I'm not dead. Yeah, that whole thing.
It's weird with Monty Python because I've only seen the popular scenes. I remember seeing the one where they're cutting his arms off. And I remember seeing the one where the guy, oh no, I can't eat another bite. And he's going to eat another mint or something and explode.
And then explodes. Yeah.
But I don't remember ever watching one from beginning to end. I can't say I ever have.
Yeah, never been. I don't dislike it, but I've never been, you know, a huge fan or like a Python fanatic or anything. So,
what about you, Trenchcoat? Did you watch any of them?
Yeah, I think I got into the show when I was a teenager. You never saw that sketch about the dead parrot?
No.
Or the lumberjack song, I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. There are so many great bits.
Was that off the TV show?
Yes.
Yeah, I never saw the TV show. I remember the TV show coming on like VH1 later in life, and I never really watched it.
Life of Brian was another good Monty Python movie when the guys are getting crucified and they sing Always Look on the Brighter Side of Life. That was hilarious.
Yeah. I've seen parts of that movie. I've heard that song other places. Is Life of Brian the one where they have like, it's a sex ed class and the sex ed teacher actually has sex in front of the class to teach them sex ed?
I think that was Meaning of Life.
Meaning of Life, that would make sense. I was scared. There was that pause there. I thought maybe I just like made something up and revealed some bizarre dream I had or something.
Yeah, and that question was from Jim Dietz, and have an interesting story about how me and Jim met. Well, we never physically met, but we met on the internet. Is through Geek Brunch, because he does his own physical Geek Brunch. Like, he's a chef, and he has Geek Brunch on Sundays.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Small world.
Yeah. All right.
We got a few more, but we could just go through them really quick. This is from @ThePureMute on Twitter. If a coworker and a loved one interrupts a planned Geek Brunch gathering, what is the correct protocol to make them leave? I never can do that. So, in other words,
say your house is on fire.
I plan ahead and I never get into that situation. But family comes first. So, like, if we're doing something, I usually cancel the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's it. Would it be like Geek Brunch for meaning specifically getting together to do the podcast?
I guess so. Or interrupts a planned Geek Brunch gathering. Like, I guess it could be any kind of geek gathering, because he says, he mentioned something else. So it almost like if you're just trying to meet with friends to talk geeky things and somebody interrupts. Coworkers never interrupt me because I keep my work and my podcasting life separate.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess sounds like if you were desperate, you could get Harley in there and she could fall asleep and just start farting.
Yeah, she could.
Clear the room.
I got to take her for a walk today. She didn't get to go yesterday because it was like 12 below zero, so it was a bad day. Chris Pfeiffer asked, did you ever submit or design any Dial H characters back when the book was based on reader submissions in the 70s or early 80s? And that's for me a no, because I didn't even read Dial H back in that time. I've discovered Dial H way later. Trenchcoat, did you submit anything?
Nope. I never did. I never read the comic back then when I could do that.
I know Chris had tracked somebody down, didn't you, that created a character?
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's the closest I ever came. I don't think I could actually – I don't think I had learned to write when that was happening, so I didn't do it myself. But, yeah, if you haven't heard it, you can go back and listen to – I think it was our second or third episode. I had I found somebody on Twitter that had contributed to the 16-page preview of Dial H, because I noticed that he lived in a town nearby, and I just like Googled his name and the name of the town out of curiosity, and a Twitter account popped up, and I sent him a message on Twitter, and turned out to it was him. And he said that he never got the t-shirt that they promised him.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the closest I've come to any kind of Dial H interaction.
And then the next question from Chris Pfeiffer is, favorite breakfast cereal for Saturday morning cartoons?
Fruity Pebbles.
I would go with Fruity Pebbles because to this day, I will have a bowl of Fruity Pebbles. It's the most consistent cereal that I've liked and never got sick of.
I think I liked Cocoa Pebbles better when I was a kid.
Mm.
But nowadays, I think, well, not nowadays, but other ones, I liked Cinnamon Toast Crunch too. That was good.
I like Shrek's when that was popular because it was like a marshmallow sugar cereal. And it was not like Lucky Charms. It was much sweeter. It was like a sugar adrenaline rush.
Shrek like the movie?
Yeah. And then Scooby-Doo cereal, the latest Scooby-Doo cereal that I've tried, which is brand new, it sucks. It's like a vanilla frosted bone, and it tastes really bad. But they used to have a very good cereal called Scooby-Doo's or something like that, and I like that one.
There actually used to be a cereal called Vanilla Crunch. That's the only other vanilla cereal I can even think of.
I wonder if that was it, like this new Scooby-Doo cereal, because I don't like it, and I never tried that other one. He said his was Freakies, and I don't remember Freakies.
I do. They were okay.
What was it like compared to something that's on the shelf today?
I don't think it had marshmallows, though, like the cereal you mentioned. All I can remember is I used to eat it sometimes. I also remember, believe it or not, there was a Mr. T cereal. The pieces were shaped like T's, the letter.
I just Googled Freakies, and I did eat Freakies. They were pretty good. They did have marshmallows. They were very much like the Scooby-Doo cereal or the Shrek cereal that I used to eat. This is a cereal that doesn't seem to last long. Like, it's in limited edition, and they usually change it and morph it with some commercial property. But that was a damn good cereal. If I remember, it was like between Lucky Charms and Captain Crunch. Like a taste.
Oh, yeah, Captain Crunch.
Yeah, that's another one that's good, but I can only do that in every now and then because that is some sharp-ass cereal. If you don't, soak it in milk.
I like Crunch Berries and Peanut Butter Crunch. There used to be a cereal called Cinnamon Crunch. Crunch, but I didn't have that ever because I hate cinnamon.
There's a new cinnamon one out that I like. It's like cinnamon app. I can't remember what it's called. Cinnamon Jacks. It's like Apple Jacks, but it's just cinnamon. That's good. I'm eating that now.
Yeah, I don't know why they cut back on the sugar. For most of the sugar cereals, back in the 70s, they were a lot sweeter. They're not even allowed to call themselves, like, Sugar Crisp is called what now? Something else. They're not even allowed to have the word sugar in the title.
You know what they really sucked up? I mean, as far as taking the sugar out, I used to love to have Quick strawberry milk, and I used to pile on the sugar on the bottom of the milk, and now they have like this 1/3 less sugar. It tastes terrible.
I don't know.
Good.
No, I was just gonna say that I don't know because I nowadays I eat like boring healthy adult cereal anyways.
Boo. Never went there. I'm still eating the sugar shit.
Even though Raisin Bran is kind of okay.
I used to get the healthiest cereal I think that I would eat is Cheerios, but then I would coat it in sugar. In other words, I get a spoonful of sugar and sprinkle it on top.
Now they have frosted Cheerios that are already pre-sugared for you.
Yeah. And Frosted Flakes I like. Those are good. Those will cut you up, too. You're not careful.
Yeah, you gotta
be careful. Absorb milk really good. So it's not like Cap'n Crunch, man. Those things will cut you up if you don't soak them in milk.
Like, doctor, he has lacerations of the mouth. What happened? He ate a whole bowl of Captain Crunch cereal, sir.
And he mentioned also, as his last comment, was there any of the cereals that you remember getting toys out of? And I can't remember. I remember buying cereal strictly for the toy, and a lot of times the cereal sucked. But I remember going to the grocery store and saying, I want to try this because it's got this cool toy. But I'd rather stick with the loyal ones like the Fruity Pebbles and the Apple Jacks. And
yeah, well, I would Freakies walk down the aisle and say Freaky Magnets. That's the only prizes I can ever remember.
Yeah, the magnets, and it looks like they had the toys of the characters, like little plastic ones that you could collect.
I used to go down the aisle and just look at, you know, not what the cereals were, but what the prizes were that were included, and pick it out that way.
I remember mini comics and some of them. I get confused between the prizes in cereal and the prizes that were in Cracker Jacks. Because I think Cracker Jacks used to do the tattoo thing, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Temporary tattoos. Yeah. All right, and then the last segment is, did you guys have any miscellaneous retro comics you wanted to talk about real quick?
I read a bunch. I don't have to talk about them all this time. I could save some for next time, depending on how much you want to do.
Let's do a couple.
Okay. I got a quick one. I read DC Comics Presents number 19.
Nice. I read one too.
Oh, nice. It's just a random one that I had. It's, you know, these were all team-ups with Superman. This one is a team-up with him and Batgirl. It's written by Denny O'Neil and pencils by Joe Staton. Came out in 1980. You know, and that's a pretty good creative team. I'm a Batgirl fan and stuff, but you know, a lot of times with DC Comics Presents, I mean, they're one and done, which I appreciate that. About them. The story itself is a little bit silly. It's basically about this sort of prospector guy that is kind of down on his luck, and he sees this mansion sort of magically appear in the desert. So then it fast forwards in time when he's made like a fortune off of selling stuff that he found in the house and treats it as a tourist attraction. So Clark Kent is there covering it for the Daily Planet, and Barbara Gordon's there just because she needs a break, so she's just on vacation to check it out. But the effect of the place on the people that are there, it causes them to become really angry with each other. So, like, the slightest offense will cause people to attack each other. And there's weird, like, haunted house type stuff. Like, they sit down to a meal and all the wine glasses are filled with blood. So, Superman kind of, like, keeps turning back and forth in between his Clark Kent identity and his real identity and his Superman identity as stuff goes wrong. And meanwhile, like, Barbara goes and changes into her Batgirl costume. She's kind of like, you know, as appropriate to their power levels, she's kind of taking care of like the people on the ground level, and whereas Superman's dealing with more of like he rushes someone to safety because the guy that was hurt was the actual helicopter pilot, so there's no way to get him out, so he does that. And eventually it turns out that there's this guy. It's actually funny because the cover pretty much reveals the surprise that there's this weird obelisk inside the building. And eventually it turns out that the being that is causing all this stuff to happen and who is kind of linked to this house psychically or whatever is this Dr. Horus guy. It's like a human body with a bird head. He's inside of the obelisk. And you see on the cover of the comic that, you know, the obelisk with Superman tearing it open and him inside, so it's not much of a surprise. You know, everything gets wrapped up neat and tidy at the end. It wasn't terrible. The art's pretty good, and I like the old school Batgirl look. But it was kind of a silly plot. It wasn't the, you know, greatest story ever.
I don't think any of them were.
No.
But
they're always a bit silly.
That's cool. Joe Staton art. He's got a very cool style. I always think of E-Man when I see Joe Staton, but I've been reading Millennium, and he did that crossover, so.
Oh, okay.
That's cool. I read 33, which is another Superman and Captain Marvel or Shazam, and this one was unique in the fact that in our Earth, Captain Marvel is just a, you know, comic book, and but Superman's well aware that he really exists on Earth S. It's the multiverse, and it's inverted and hit on Earth S. Superman's a comic book or TV show character, and they just know each other through that, and then they could go through the Rock of Eternity and visit each other's worlds. But Mixel Pidelic, or I don't know how to pronounce it. I've heard Mixelplick, Mixel Pidelic, all kinds of different versions of it. He decides to F with Superman, and when he becomes Superman, he becomes Shazam, and on Earth-S, Shazam becomes Superman. And it's almost like Superman's like, crap, he doesn't know what to do because he doesn't have his vision. He doesn't have all those other powers that he's used to. And now he just has super strength, so it's hard for him to adjust. At the same time, Billy Batson is having a hard time adjusting. And then they go to each other's worlds. And it turns out Mixel Pidelic teamed up with Mr. Mind, and it's continued in the next issue. But Billy Batson's objectives are, let's eat some pie. Or it's funny because they say, let's go eat some strawberry creeps. How do they pronounce it? Creeps? Aren't those the things that they wrap really tightly, and they're like fruity? What is a crepe?
Crepe. It's like a real thin
cylinder.
Batter.
But isn't it like a cylinder shape or no?
They kind of fill. They start off as like a real thin batter, like an extra thin pancake almost, like, and then they fill them with different things, and then they roll it up with the filling like an enchilada or something.
That's what I thought they were, but the artist depicted as pie because when they go there, that distracted me. She was cutting pie. But they were eating strawberry crepes.
That's funny.
Yeah. So, yeah, the art was really nice. Let me see who did it. It was Jerry Conway was the plotter, and the scripter was Roy Thomas, and Rick Buckler, who did the giant-size collector's edition, Superman versus Shazam. So that's why it looks so good. It was the same artist. It looks very much like George Perez art. So that was cool. You got anything?
So it was. Oh yeah, I was gonna say. So he was ripping off Perez.
Yeah, yeah, he's kind of ripping off on Perez art. Did I lose
four?
Lost you guys for a split second. You said was he ripping off Perez art?
He was ripping off Jack Kirby style when he was drawing FF for Marvel. I was going to say my retro comic then is Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes from August of 75. It was the first Legion comic I ever read. And I've been a Legion fan ever since because this story was so good, even though Jim Shooter wrote it, and he usually sucks.
You don't like Jim Shooter?
No, because I read Secret Wars too.
Oh. No, but didn't you read other stuff? Like what did he do? He did all the Valiant stuff initially.
I liked his Avengers. That's about it. But this story at least had great art by Mike Grell. It's about this soldier who gets blown up and buried and somehow brought back to life. And he fights the Legion, and the Legion basically kills him again. And that's supposed to be a happy ending somehow.
Do you know what
number? Like I said,
what number was this? Shooter,
210.
210.
Yeah. And there's a backup story that's about Karate Kid. I don't know how he ever got to be a legionnaire in the first place. Oh, I can do karate. That's my superpower. And they let him in team.
Yeah, I haven't read any Legion that old. The oldest Legion I've read is starting right where Superboy left for a while and got his own title. And it became just Legion of Superheroes for the first time.
They keep rebooting the Legion, though.
Yeah.
Zero Hour, Crisis. Oh, they keep doing it over and over again.
Yeah, definitely.
So, that's my retro comic, I guess.
Did they happen to show Cosmic Boy in there? That issue?
No.
Okay.
Not this time.
Because didn't Mike Grell draw him with the corset or whatever? The black weird costume?
Oh, yeah. Cosmic Boy's weird.
Yeah.
The pink costume where he's dressed like a male stripper?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was Mike Grell that did that.
I think Grell redesigned most of them.
Yeah, I was wondering if he showed up in that particular issue.
No, this has Brainiac 5, Chameleon Lad or Chameleon Boy, Phantom Girl, I don't remember who else, Princess Projectora maybe. So,
you know which one I'm liking a lot now and I want to learn more about is Night. Is it Night Girl? The one that gets the power at night?
So it's a beater. You just got a fighter during the day. Yeah.
You still have the power of flight. You got the flight ring.
That's cheating, though. Does she even have a flight ring? Isn't she with the Substitute Legion?
Well, right now she's an instructor. So, yeah, I think she's... I don't know if she's ever been like a major legionnaire.
All those substitute guys are useless. like Chlorophyll Kid, Color Lad,
Matter Eater Lad.
Yeah!
I'm just going to eat some shit.
He actually, when the real Legion, fortunately they had the good sense to kill him, and then they messed up and brought him back to life, though.
Yeah.
And Triplicate Girl, one of herself got killed, and then she became Duo Damsel.
Yeah, and then isn't she married to Bouncing Boy?
Yeah.
That guy's got it made, man. He's got three chicks. Every fantasy you've ever thought about right there.
Well, they're all identical, though. So I can't be pretend he's doing someone else.
Yeah, but there'd be three of them. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I would take it. I wouldn't complain. Maybe they could each cut their hair different or something.
No, I don't think that would work, because I think if they cut their hair different, they'd all look with the haircut.
Oh, well.
I've never seen a Legion of Superheroes comics where they've been split and look different. Have you? Any of you?
No, I don't. No. I think you're right. That was just wishful thinking.
Maybe they could wear one where it can wear a wig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would probably work.
Did you have any others you wanted to quickly mention, Chris?
It doesn't matter. I could save the rest of stuff I read.
I got two quick ones. Okay. Wonder Woman 224 from 1976. This is some cool shit. I really like this Wonder Woman stuff. It's ridiculous as hell, but she's actually falling in love with Earth 2 Steve Trevor. In other words, Earth 1 Steve Trevor's dead. But she finds out that she's arrested because they've been taking down planes and stuff like that around Paradise Island, saying it's the Bermuda Triangle. And she actually works with her mother to frame the Amazon that's doing that. And they have, like, in this period, they get, like, ridiculous powers. Like, she used her super breath to uproot some trees. And then as the trees are uprooted and floating, she, like, karate chops them into, like, splinters and makes a prison for these Amazons. I'm like, that's since awesome.
When does she have super breath? I thought only Superman had that.
Well, maybe in issue 224, she gained that ability. But it was a cool issue. I liked it. And then we get the what do they call it? The public service announcements with Superman. This one is a bunch of kids are playing basketball, and these kids are pointing to this other kid, and they say, "Hey, look at Pete. He's going into juvenile court. I wonder what trouble he got into. He must be in all kinds of trouble." And then Superman comes in. Pete's in no trouble at all. Just because he goes into the courthouse, he might be going there for other reasons. And then this guy from the court says he can go there for foster homes, counseling, tutoring, and even health care. I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? but it was awesome. It was awesome. And then the other one I want to mention, I am on a kick on this weird War Tales 111. I'm trying to fill the whole gap because I'm digging the Creature Commandos, and this one has G.I. Robot, and it's by Robert Karinger, and Dan Spiegel is the artist, and it has the usual Velcro, the Vampire, Taylor, the Mute Monster, which is the Frankenstein, Griffin, the Werewolf, and it has Dr. Medusa. And what I learned is that lieutenant that has these guys, he's a freaking asshole. He treats these monsters like a dick. I mean, I wish they'd beat the shit out of him. But he takes them to a bunch of little kids to try to make them laugh because they're monsters. And it doesn't work out. They end up laughing at him, at the lieutenant. And they introduce, they have G.I. Robot with another soldier, another sergeant there, and all the sergeant's doing is bitching. He says, they sent me on patrol with the robot. I can't even talk to you, and you have no, you don't care about anything. And all of a sudden, they start getting shot at on this island by Japanese soldiers, and G.I. Robot saves them. And they launch a grenade at G.I. Robot, and this soldier decides to jump on top of the grenade to save the robot. I thought that was kind of interesting. But it was a cool. And then there's like pterodactyls on this island and stuff, and dinosaurs, and they run into Aztecs. It has like seven different. You talk about decompressed storytelling. This is the opposite. It has so many storylines in this that they crammed at least. If this was a Bendis comic, it would have been 20 issues.
That's Bendis.
This one has so many plot lines, it's hard to describe every single one of them. It has this. It has the Bermuda Triangle in it. It's got Aztecs from Atlantis in it. It's crazy. And they're robots, but it's awesome. I'd recommend reading these. These are fun books.
What number was that Wonder Woman that you're?
Wonder Woman was 224, and Weird War Tales was 111. That was from 1982.
Weird, yeah. I remember looking through like the DC history book that I have, and they talked about that stretch of Weird War Tales or the Creature Commandos, and I've always thought that concept was really fascinating. You know, the whole idea.
Yeah, and the stories are so fun. Like, they're ridiculous and fun.
It's a really cool mashup of genres.
This was the year that Swamp Thing, the movie, came out with Louis Jordan and Adrian Barbeau. Is that how you pronounce it?
Adrian Barbeau, yeah.
I liked the movie. I saw that at the theaters.
She's a pretty famous B-movie actress from back then.
Yeah, she's got some big breasts.
That might be part of her fame.
Did you see the sequel?
Yes, I saw that, and I even watched the damn TV show on USA Network. The only thing that improved from the first one is the costume got better from from movie to movie.
Meanwhile, Alan Moore was writing the comic, and the comic was like about 50 times better than the movies.
Oh yeah. It was a monster fight thing in the movies. But it was kind of like it started before Alan Moore got a hold of it. It was more like the movie. Not in the House of Mystery and stuff. Those were fucking awesome, like the 20 Cent comics, but when the movie came out, they released the all-new Swamp Thing or whatever, and the first few issues were by somebody else.
Martin Pasco.
Yeah, and then Alan Moore took over and changed the character. Yeah, it was good comics. So, you want to wrap up? Do you have any other things you want to mention? Chris or Trenchcoat?
Yeah, I want to tell the listeners to go to podcastdex.blogspot.com. Chris?
Other than our, you know, we'll run through our usual contact info and stuff, but in addition to that, I'll mention people check out criticalmassesmedia.com. I said that kind of fast, so criticalmassesmedia.com. That's a blog I started about four years ago or something with my friends Ryan and Matt, and I post some stuff about music there. They post about music and movies, and they just started a podcast. I say they because I might be on a future episode, but Ryan and Matt recorded an episode with Ryan's brother Evan. They're going to talk about a movie and an album each episode, and at some point I'll probably join them, but you can go there and check that out.
You can take your Alvin and the Chipmunks there.
Yeah, there you go. When they ask me for an episode idea, I'll say, let's watch the Alvin and the Chipmunks movie and listen to the Christmas album. And then I'll never be on the show again. But yeah, check that out.
I have one shout out for somebody, Gary Arkel. He actually sent me some of those Kirby cards that you'd gotten.
Awesome.
These were the prototypes, so he sent me a couple of those, and I want to thank him for doing that. I really need to hunt them down because they're pretty freaking awesome. Especially Kirby fan. I didn't even know they existed, so.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. I haven't tried to search for them since I found mine, but when I found out about them, I did an eBay search and found them pretty easily, and they were pretty cheap. So,
how many cards are in the deck? Is it like?
I think I still have them nearby here. Yeah, here they are. They fit in like a little. I don't know if you ever seen like baseball cards, like a little plastic case. But let me see. There's a checklist in the back, so I can. Including the checklist, 90 cards.
90 cards.
Yeah, so it's just a nice little set. It's not, you know, doesn't take up much space.
Cool.
Yeah. So, came out in the 90s, it looks like. So, but yeah, for those that didn't hear the episode, that's basically a little collector card set of concepts that Jack Kirby came up with for Ruby Spears Animation Studio that were never really turned into anything. And they're, if you're a Kirby fan, they're definitely worth seeking out because there's some really fun Kirby-esque, you know, not Kirby-esque, but Kirby himself ideas. And they're fun to flip through.
Awesome. They look awesome. I imagine the cards he sent me were like the prototypes or something that might have come in a magazine or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're awesome. I want to seek them out. So thanks, Gary. This has been Geek Brunch Retrocast 10. Did we hit 10?
I think it's either 10 or 11.
I think it's 10. And I want to thank Trenchcoat Mafia from Podcast X, and you could catch him from time to time at Thum with Timmy Thum, both of which are retro podcasts, so you'll be getting old comic books. And the one that I heard last, you guys were talking about Eerie Magazine and some pregnant monster baby.
That was a great story. I liked it anyway.
And it had one of my favorite artists, believe it or not. At least he's becoming one of my favorites in modern comics. What was his name? He's a horror.
Richard Corbin,
yeah. He's doing a lot of comics for Dark Horse and Dark Horse Presents now. And Conan, he did some stuff, and I'm digging his work. It's a very dark style. I don't know what it was back then, but I like it now. So check that out. And let's see. Our contact information. Do you want to give out any of your contact information?
No, because my computer has a virus. So the podcastx@hotmail.com isn't really working right now. So, although people could leave comments on the PCX website if they want.
There you go.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
And we have Twitter accounts at Mike Myers Brunch and at Mythmaking ETC, like etc. And we are located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. We got a Facebook page, Geek Brunch Podcast, that you can search for and like it. And anything else I missed, Chris?
Email mike@comicbooknoise.com and mythmakingetc@gmail.com. Forums for geeks. I think that's about it.
Yeah, scroll down there and you can leave comments there. can leave comments on the website. Thanks for all the questions. We've been getting some good questions that have...
Yeah.
Pretty soon, if this keeps up, we don't even have to come up with our own topics. Because we could make a lot of discussion on the ones that we get.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate it. And I'm always like really excited and appreciative to find out when anyone says that they're listening and enjoying the show. It means a lot to me. So those of you who have done so, thanks a lot for speaking up and letting us know that you're listening to the show and enjoying it.
Cool. And we'll talk to you. Maybe you could come back on again soon. And we could do some more Kirby love.
Yeah, Trenchcoats, thanks for coming on. It's good to get a chance to talk to you.
You too. If you want me back on the show anytime, Mike, just email me. You have my secret email account with my real name. So, yeah.
Yeah. I knew I didn't want to say that because I know it's a secret account.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you all, and I'll have a good what's left of a Sunday. And thank you for joining us again. Appreciate it. It's always a good time talking to you.
Yeah, take care, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Paying the price!